Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, voters are now evenly split on whether Congress should begin impeachment proceedings against Trump. Does this mean the Democrats might actually pull it off? We open the lines and ask you. And despite increasing income inequality in the United States, the American dream can still be achieved in Canada. Economist Raj Chetty is working to fix that. We talked to him about how he's trying to break the cycle of poverty for a generation born into it. Then at noon, Emily Rooney is here, of course, for her famous list of fixations and fulminations.
So you're already worried about ice dams? Feeling guilty? You don't have a water-saving dishwasher? The expert from This Old House will be here to field all your home repair and improvement questions. And Walmart did some soul-searching and found it. We talked to the Boston Globe's Shirley Young about how the symbol of callous corporate greed found a social conscience. All that is next on Boston Public Radio. Egan, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. You know, before we get started today, mm-hmm. we just wanted to mention an event that you and I were honored to be included in last night. It was the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Pine Street Inn, which has really changed the world when it comes to homeless people. And it was just the governor was there, the mayor was there. Judy Collins paid tribute to the organization, sang five or six incredibly beautiful and relevant songs. It was a moving, wonderful, wonderful night.
Well, you know what's a great thing? I think lots of people think of Pine Street Inn as a homeless shelter.
Yep, exactly
right. But
they
are so much more. Their emphasis is on getting people in houses. And we had the opportunity to talk to a gentleman a couple of weeks ago, remember, who had written about being homeless and who talked about what it was like to finally, after many years on the street, to be unlock the door to his own place, close the door to his own place. They have really been usually successful in getting people housing, and that's what it's all about.
And by the way, if you have any interest in volunteering or doing anything with the organization, it really is one of a kind. And it was a great night, and we were thrilled to be there. It's Pine Street Inn. So it is time for our impeachment inquiry, I guess, asking you where you are today on impeaching the president. In the weeks since we learned that Trump pressured Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden, a number of polls show there's an uptick in support for impeaching the president. And now we're taking your calls asking if this includes you, and if it does, why? 877-301-8970. Has the whistleblower's complaint changed things for you? Did yesterday's Intelligence Committee hearing sway you one way or the other? Is this freak show one you can't turn away from or one you can't bear to watch? 877-301-897. You know what struck me most, I think?
What?
Is how lightning fast the world changes. I mean, it's just in just a matter of days, because of one human being, because of a New York Times reporting a CIA employee, because of one whistleblower in this whole huge federal government, the world has totally changed. And if people think the Trump administration is going to blow this off like everything else, is a great story in NBC News, well documented, quote, total panic as shell-shocked White House struggles to find impeachment footing. And I have to say, there is more confidence and maybe even more competence in the usually gang that couldn't shoot straight Democratic Party in Congress the last couple of days, that it seems they're at least beginning to gain some footing.
Well, there's always the opportunity that the Democrats can screw it up. Because
well, of course they can, and they have.
As we've said many times, at pure, raw, vicious politics, the Republicans are much better at it than the Democrats. But this is a tough one, because as we've said a million times, the president admitted doing this himself. Rudy Giuliani, who seems to have gone off the rails, admitted doing it himself. And it will be interesting to see what happens as these investigations go on.
Meaning what?
Well, Republicans are pretty much with him now. Our governor, Charlie Baker, says he thinks the inquiry into impeachment is legitimate.
One of two Republican governors, Vermont and Baker, are the two. Yeah.
And two senators, our former Mitt Romney from here, said that he was very troubled by these things, and Ben Sasse has indicated there's some there. But if if the inquiry continues and Trump starts to sink in the polls and more Americans want impeachment, then the Republicans, who have kind of sold their soul at this point to this president, you know, they're political animals. When they think that he's not going to do them much good, I think it's possible you will see a retreat from him.
Well, it also is a function of how well the Democrats convey the message here. One of the things I've been reading this morning, I'm sure you have too, is the Democrats, at least through Pelosi, are suggesting this should not be a drawn-out affair. They hope to present, if they do, articles of impeachment by the end of October. And the question, I mean, again, I know people got a lot of angry email about yesterday, Jim, you talking about the message, who the front person is. It matters what they convey. There's a whole debate, by the way, as you know, within the Democratic caucus. Should this be focused on Ukraine? Should impeachment inquiries broaden to other things that some members of the Democratic Party feel are impeachable offenses? Like everything else in American politics, I don't mean disingenuously, but it's got to be simplified so the American people come along. The one thing I always agreed with Pelosi about is ultimately, the American people have to be supportive of this. Her philosophy until a few days ago was they have to be supportive before we even begin it. They have now begun it, and for it to reach a conclusion, whatever that is, the American people have got to be supportive of it, or there will be a crisis in the democracy. And this polling, has, as I said at the beginning, shows that just in the last few days, there has been a fairly significant uptick. In some polls, there's a slight majority for impeachment, while there was a decent minority, including among Democrats, by the way, up until this whole Ukraine thing broke. And we're also going to talk a little bit later with Emily Rooney. The New York Times has identified, as I'm sure you all know, based upon, I think, three sources, that the whistleblower is a CIA person who was assigned to the White House. And we're going to talk about whether or not they didn't disclose his identity, but disclosing essentially what he or she is or what their job is, did the New York Times cross a line and arguably put that person at risk? I'm with the New York Times. I think their arguments for disclosing what they did made sense.
Well, I think that they had taken a lot of criticism. I'm with the New York Times, too. But the commentary on the whistleblower complaint has talked about how you can tell that this is an intelligence person that really knows what they're talking about, and you can tell that they understand the way these things work in the White House, and you can tell that this person has extensive knowledge of European affairs, specifically in Ukraine. So it's a very careful, very clear. I mean, it's really worth reading. This person is a very good writer. You know, it's very straightforward, and you know, as we said yesterday, I mean, he lays everything out like it's a very well written newspaper piece that the president is using the power of his office to interfere with the 2020 elections. So it's very straightforward. Anyway, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org. You can tweet us at Boston Public Radio. What do you think about the current situation with the impeachment? Do you have confidence in the Democrats? Are you worried about that? You know, he's a very good Republican, too, the guy in the Senate, Burr, that's in the Senate.
Chair of the Intelligence Committee.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the ranking minority there.
He's a very impressive guy, and I have a lot of hope that he will run good hearings.
The chair. I'm sorry, the Republican chair, yeah.
He will run good good questions. He'll run a good hearing.
Well, you know what the beauty of that committee is, as opposed to the House committee, which is chaired by Schiff and used to be chaired by the completely incompetent and corrupt Devin Nunes, who's now the ranking minority. He was the bagman for the president, essentially.
Bagman. Well, the ethics people did clear him, Jim.
Yeah, I would say he was the bagman. Burr and it's Warner, who's the Democrat ranking member, right, Warner?
Right.
They get along respectfully.
They've
had some disagreement, but that is how, even if you have ideological differences, theoretically, how this is all supposed to work. And I think that's good for democracy. In any case, 877-301-8970. We're sort of at the end, maybe the first chapter of this book. Where are you on this? And I'm much more interested than where you are is whether you've been moved at all by what you've learned the last few days based upon the summary of the phone call that happened on July 25th, and then your reading of or reading about or hearing about the whistleblower complaint, which obviously we got yesterday morning, or the rather odd testimony, at least I found it odd, from the acting director of National Intelligence yesterday, who I think seemed to be squirming a little bit.
Well, by the way,
in his chair.
Obama's guy, he'd been for many presidents, I guess, the guy, James Clapper, that's on television all the time, that's a former head of intelligence thing, he defended him. He said he was between a rock and a hard place because the whistleblower law did not anticipate that the object of the whistleblowing would be the president of the United States, so it did put him in a difficult position. And by the way, I learned in this New York Times story, I didn't know this, that the lawyer for the supposed CIA whistleblower, she went to the White House, too. So, and they also went to the Department of Justice. So there is this weird conflict of interest to go to the subjects of the complaints, the alleged wrongdoers, to ask them what you should do about the wrongdoing is odd, but McGuire's not the only one who did it.
Well, you know, but let me just say one thing about that. I don't want to get lost in the weeds on legal issues, and then we'll get to your calls. There are two places where essentially McGuire took this complaint where, as Adam Schiff was asking yesterday, you essentially took it to the people
right.
who were the targets of the investigation. I don't understand how he could do anything but go to the White House lawyers on the potential for executive privilege. But as we discussed last night on my television show, in terms of the Department of Justice and their decision as to whether or not it was, quote, an urgent concern that was required to be conveyed immediately to the intelligence committees in Congress, the simple answer is Barr should have recused himself, just like Jeff Sessions recused himself in the Russia investigation, so the Department of Justice could make a decision as to whether or not there was any there without the potential or at least the appearance of interference by a man who is painted not a terribly positive way by the whistleblower. Giuliani, Barr, and the president are all painted in very troubling terms by this CIA whistleblower.
Oh, yeah. The Attorney General is up to this and is to his eye teeth, and we all remember that he essentially lied to America about what was in the Mueller report, and that lie stood for weeks, and I think that resulted in many people thinking the Mueller report wasn't a big deal, when to me it was a very big deal. And one last thing, I think it's important, too, to point out that the whistleblower himself, supposedly the CIA agent, was so upset about the CIA lawyer going to the White House and going to the Justice Department. He had just done an anonymous, he hadn't done
before the whistleblower. Yeah, that's correct.
He was so worried that this was going to get buried because he talks about all these other things getting buried, and God knows what else has been buried, that's when he decided to go the whistleblower route because he was afraid that he was being ignored.
877-301-8970. So just a few days in to this incredible mess, where are you and why are you where you are? Ellen, you're in Norwell. You're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
And to you.
Jim, first of all, I wanted to say last week, but I couldn't get through, how much I agree with you and that point about the messenger. It is so important that the Dems have somebody out there who can clearly and very concisely and quickly, that's something Pelosi does not do, quickly spout out exactly what is going on here.
Well, you know, can I just say, I'm glad you agree, but, you know, for those who are upset about this, everything in life, it doesn't matter whether you're a salesperson, you're president of the United States, you're Barack Obama trying to explain the Affordable Care Act, which he did horribly, by the way. The messenger is often as important as the message, so it's not some radical thought, but I'm glad we agree, Ellen. Continue.
I agree 100%. And I thought that he should have been impeached after Helsinki. I really do.
Oh, when he stood
with Putin.
Yeah.
Believe that. And it just, you're sitting there and you're thinking to yourself, think about this. We have not been attacked on our soil since 2001. Why is that? Because of the CIA, because of the FBI, because of the NSA, because of all these people who have thwarted time and time again things that might have happened to our American citizens, he does not care a whit about that.
Well, people,
he cares about himself.
We should just point out, if people have forgotten, that Helsinki was when Trump got up there with Putin at his side and basically said he didn't believe the United States intelligence services that we just mentioned, the CIA, the FBI, et cetera, that he said Putin denied that there was any involvement in the election, and he was taking Putin's side and not the American intelligence agency's side.
Before we continue for a second, I was just confirming that my memory was good. When you mentioned James Clapper before, and CNN has him on a lot, one of the things that troubles me about that, do you remember Ron Wyden senator from Oregon, former legal services lawyer, I should say, like somebody else we know, had Clapper in front of his committee years ago, and Clapper lied.
He did lie.
About surveillance of the American people.
He did lie.
And so, you know, again, while we often say, well, how can one of these lying Trump officials be a commentator on a credible news network? I mean, I think there's a serious question as to Clapper's credibility. And he and Brennan, I'm not criticizing Brennan, are the go-to people on these issues for at least our favorite cable network, CNN.
We'll
877.
Clapper, he should be not on TV anymore.
301-8970.
Let's go to Deirdre from North Kingston. Hi, Deirdre.
Hello, Deirdre.
Hi, good morning.
Hey.
Good morning. I called yesterday, and I doubted the Democrats' ability to deliver.
I know.
And
poor
I
Democrats.
Swear to God, it's happening again. I mean, look at Representative Schiff. He starts out with this melodramatic start to the hearings. He could have just stuck to the facts, recited straight from the transcript.
Oh, you mean that mobster thing he did, basically converting the call between the Ukraine president and our president into a mobster exchange kind of thing? Yeah, I thought that was a little odd too.
Yeah. Right. Well,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say he's better than Jerry Nadler. I mean, the pickings may be slim, Deirdre. You know, they need a lawyer. They should get a lawyer, but they just want to, I don't know, all spout off and rant.
By the way, most of them are lawyers, Marjorie, but being a lawyer does not mean you know how
they
to ask a question.
They need to get a litigator. You know, we can all remember.
They need to be concise.
Yeah.
And they need to stick to the facts. If they stick to the facts in this case, in this situation, then they could prevail. But if they continue to grandstand, the message gets lost. The it's bipartisan, clearly. That's not the way to go.
Deirdre, thanks for your call.
Well, you know what was really terrible about yesterday's hearing? They spent all this time trying to figure out whether McGuire went to the right place with the complaint. No one ever explained what the complaint was.
Did they read the whistleblower complaint?
No, they didn't. So if you were tuning in and didn't know it, you'd have to go online.
But that's where the message matters. The issue that they raised for the first hour about the decision not to give it to Congress, as is mandated by these urgent concern things and why DOJ, Department of Justice, said what it did, why the White House said what it did. Those are important issues, but much harder to grasp. You lead with the thing that an average busy person in this country can understand.
Right.
And I think the whole phone call thing and some of the cover-up, the lockdown of the transcript after the president said the phone call was perfect and how transparent he was being, and then we learned from the whistleblower report that allegedly they moved to lock down with the words, the transcript
and
of the call immediately after it happened.
They have locked down many other things that are not of a national security concern, but of a political concern. In other words, the president saying things that they were so concerned about people finding out that had nothing to do with national security, but had to do with politics, that they locked them down to. Anyway, we're talking about the impeachment inquiry. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library on another incredibly beautiful day. If you're just tuning in, we're taking your calls on day three, I think, of the impeachment inquiry and week one of the Trump-Ukraine affair at 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Steve in Arlington. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, good afternoon. Hey, I'm just a little confused. I'm not a lawyer or anything, but everything this credible witness is saying is it's hearsay. So if the people that actually heard it, why aren't they coming forward if they're protected? Because in a court of law, anything he said is inadmissible. And the only reason we know what's in that transcript is because Trump released it. And everything that he released by law, he didn't have to. And because he's being so transparent, he released it right away, too.
Well, he was so transparent, so transparent of the perfect call that immediately after the perfect call on July 25th, they attempted a lockdown so that no one could see the call. That's number one. Number two, while you were right that the whistleblower's information is second and third hand, I think that was written on August 12th. And I think what's significant is one thing we are able to confirm the accuracy of is his description of the July 25th call, which none of us knew about till a month later. And I would argue if he is spot on this one critical ingredient that even you mentioned, then it's reasonable to suggest that he's credible in other things. And lastly about this, if I may, Steve, as you know, if you've been listening, the Inspector General had 14 days to re-examine the quote, urgent concerns of the whistleblower, and he found them to be credible.
But we don't even have to go there, Steve. The president himself has said he talked to Zelensky about Joe Biden. Rudy Giuliani has said he went to Ukraine to go after Biden, the president's likely opponent, maybe not, we don't know, but at this point looks like his likely opponent in the race. So the president has admitted himself doing what we just spent 2 years to find out if he did in the Mueller report. That's, I think...
Well, it's one piece, though. The whistleblower does go beyond that.
The whistleblower goes beyond that. But you can hear the president's own voice saying, yeah, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, Steve. So I think that's kind of the problem. You can all hear him admitting that he, you know, went after this Zelensky guy to get him to... He doesn't say interfere in the election, but he admits he talked to him about Biden. So he admits it. You know what I'm saying?
How about it, Steve?
Biden's the one that started this whole mess when he said he's the one that got that lawyer fired back in May. And that's when Trump said, let's get him investigated. So Biden started the whole thing.
Well, actually, it is not when Trump said get him investigated, actually. Steve, thank you for the call. You know, by the way, one of the things we've talked a lot about, you know, there are many people who have more expertise than you and I do who say that a quid pro quo is not necessary, meaning was it clear that you're not going to get your $391 million in military aid to fight off the Russian-backed separatists, but a point's made in the last 24 hours, which I'm embarrassed to say I hadn't thought about, when you reread this transcript or the summary of the call, the quid pro quo didn't have to be the $391 million. The quid pro quo was a meeting with the president, which is what Zelensky really needed back home. And if you read, when I reread the summary after reading that kind of analysis, I think that's a pretty clear quid pro quo for those who believe you need a quid pro quo. Some believe just making the soliciting the information that the president solicited from Zelensky in and of itself is a campaign finance violation and an impeachable offense.
We should address one of the things that Steve says.
What's the
spin coming from Trump's side now is everybody does this. You know, all these, and he lied about Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, was on television last night. The president did. But anyway, that, you know, this is, everybody does this. Everybody was over there trying to get rid of this prosecutor in Ukraine and trying to interfere in Ukraine. And even if that were accurate, which it seems not to be, they weren't interfering in Ukraine to get the election overturned or
affected.
Undone or affected by this kind of stuff. I mean, Trump did it to win the election. You know, the guy from Connecticut wasn't doing it about that. Biden, whatever he did, wasn't doing it about that. It does look awful, I think, for Biden's son to be making $50,000 a month from a gas company. But the original investigation into Biden was dormant when this whole thing began.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Paul in Worcester. You're on Boston Public Radio with me, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. Hi there.
Hi. I don't remember ever seeing anything in Washington move this fast.
You mean once it started? That's a very good point. Go ahead.
Something I think everyone should fully recognize is that if this were a Democratic president, they'd be acting exactly like the other side is now. So no recess. Keep the momentum going without falling into the grandstand traps the opposition sets. Keep your eyes on the ball and stop screwing around with partisan playground politics.
But there is partisan politics, though. I mean, I have to say, I said this yesterday, the takeaway for me that was most troubling, Paul, other than Congressman Hurd, the former CIA guy from Texas, the Republican.
He's great.
Well, he's also retiring, by the way, which often they get incredibly courageous when they're retiring. The fact that not one Republican on that committee, I wasn't looking for them to say, let's impeach him and kick him out of office. Now, the fact that not one of them could say the words, I am concerned by what I am reading. I don't know if it's true. There are allegations, and I believe we do have to inquire further for the good of our democracy and our country was so upsetting to me. It is everything is so incredibly damn partisan that it's just destructive of democracy. So you're right, the Democrats this time don't seem to be messing around, but it is still in typical American fashion in 2019 almost a wholly partisan effort. I'm not saying they're motivated by partisanship. I'm saying there's a partisan divide. Paul, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
And by the way, we probably will see, I mean, the Inspector General has already interviewed some of these witnesses.
Atkinson we're talking about?
Yes, in the White House. So I don't know how extensive these hearings are going to be, but it does seem logical that they would try to get some of these people who
were the whistleblower sources
engaged in a cover-up in the White House or the whistleblower sources to talk to them. And I think they – I don't know what's going to happen with the Attorney General because the Attorney General has been implicated in this too. And we should point out that the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, received this complaint and – didn't interview anybody.
Do you remember those thrilling days of yesteryear when you were saying on the radio how thrilled you were that someone with a record of Bill Barr was about to become the Attorney General again?
I was totally wrong. I thought that this guy's at the end of his career. I thought he might be heroic. I thought he might go in there and do the right thing. But instead, it's like he's been sucked into this Trump cult. It's really because he will not look well in history.
By the way, if some of you are wondering why we were leaving Rudy Giuliani out of this, at noon when Emily Rooney gets here, we're going to talk about Giuliani's criticism. He's very upset that the whistleblower is the hero, and he wants to know why he is not the hero of Ukraine Gate. We'll get to that at noon. Roger in Marblehead, you're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to say that I was firmly in Moulton's camp that Trump should have been impeached years ago, but despaired over the years that Pelosi would never take any action. But I believe yesterday's whistleblower testimony is like that moment in the movie Titanic when the sea has finally breached the fourth watertight compartment. And while the Republicans are partying on the deck and the band's playing, Pelosi's downstairs telling Trump that not only can the unsinkable Titanic go down, political laws now make it inevitable.
Wish I had thought of that. Go ahead.
In the coming weeks, I think you're going to see that horrifying scene where the whole stern of the Titanic lifts up into the sky, and you see the dead propellers and no rudder, and all of Trump's supporters sliding down the deck to their demise before the whole Trump presidency breaks in two and goes to the bottom of the Atlantic.
That was beautiful.
Well,
thank you. You're getting applause at the library.
From the audience. Well, they kind of look
ridiculous.
I mean, they do look so ridiculous. If you turn on Fox, they're all saying, oh, there's nothing here. There's nothing here. This is no big deal. There's no problem. All this kind of stuff. You just say, you know, these are smart people. How can they say these
things?
Who
are the smart people? The Republicans on the committee? Who are you talking about?
Well, the people that go on these television shows.
Oh.
Or the hosts themselves. I mean, you may not like... Well, maybe Sean Hannity is not that smart, actually. Remember when he was just ridiculed and humiliated by Bill O'Reilly?
We did an event many years ago, we've told you, when Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and we were on the same radio station. We were the smallest of small fries. It was an all-star thing.
Yeah.
We did our little presentation. No one clapped. No one laughed. No one anything. And we moved down the line. And the second to last speaker was Sean Hannity, who got pretty good response from the audience. And the final speaker was Bill O'Reilly before his loofah problems. Mm-hmm. And O'Reilly completely eviscerated his Fox News colleague.
Yeah, he did.
Sean Hannity. It was an incredible couple of minutes.
On the other side, you have the power of guys like Sean Hannity, who's got not only a television show, but a radio show. Mark Levin.
And a key advisor of the President of the United States on
Mark
a daily
Levin,
basis.
Huge radio show. Yeah, Rush Limbaugh, huge radio show. So those guys are all propping up the president, and we'll see how long that lasts. They have millions and millions and millions of listeners all across the country.
We only have time for one more, and it's you, Joanne, from Manchester. Welcome to the show. Hi.
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 I just wanted to say I agree with what you said about Will Hurd. I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter is actually over in Ukraine. She's a teacher over there.
Oh, really?
Wow.
And, I don't think people understand really how bad the war is over there because it's been going on for some time. And Russia has actually flown drones over into Ukraine and blown up a couple of ammunition places over there. It was on the BBC News. So for Mr. Trump to sit down with Mr. Zelensky, President Zelensky, and the people to ask, were you pushed into doing anything for the United States, but for President Trump, what's he supposed to say? He's sitting there right next to Trump.
Of course.
He needs the money to fight the war against the Russians. Of course he's going to say, yeah, President Trump's great. He's awesome. You know, he didn't push me. Otherwise, he's not going to give him the money.
Hey, Joanne,
those are great points,
Joanne,
about the desperation.
Have you spoken to your daughter since this whole thing broke?
Yeah, she actually watched the hearing yesterday.
And what kind of coverage is this, if you discuss it, what kind of coverage is this getting in Ukraine? What's the spin on this there? Do you know?
She's over on the western side, so there's not really a whole lot there. Over in Kyiv and over in the eastern side, there is a lot of people that do not really like the United States, what's going on for right now. They're disappointed in the promises that were made to them when they first became a country, and we told them, you know what, if you give up all of your Russian-made nuclear and heavy military items, then we'll protect you. And then, of course, here we are, not letting them have the money to fight the war, which we told them that we would do if they gave up all
that
stuff. So,
good luck to your kid. Sorry. You have a final thought? I'm sorry.
My final thought?
Yeah, I thought you had. I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I really hope that this comes to fruition and the Democrats take their time and really cross their T's and dot their I's, and you know, hopefully things will get set so that we can move on from this. And I am for impeachment at this point in time. And I think Speaker Pelosi did very well in waiting, and hopefully this will be something that, you know, if you're going to take somebody down, you better have all of your ducks in a row in order to do it.
Joanne, thanks a lot. See you. Thank you very much for your call.
Coming up, how a change of address can change a child's entire future. Harvard economist Raj Chetty joins us for that and more. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If geography is destiny, what does that mean for people born into low-income communities? It could mean everything. Research shows the neighborhoods that children grow up in have a profound influence on how their lives will turn out. And for those who are in disadvantaged communities, the upside is that destination can also be destiny. Change of address could be the life change that you need to break out of poverty. This is what economist Raj Chetty has found. He's the William A. Ackman Professor of Public Economics at Harvard, also the director of the Opportunity Insights Research Team. They've collaborated with public housing authorities in Seattle in an experiment that could provide a way to break the poverty cycle. He joins us to talk about this and other research. Raj Chetty, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I learned an awful lot reading about you, let me tell you. So let's start. There was a headline on an interview with you in Vox that said you have a better chance of achieving the American dream in Canada now than you have of achieving it in America. So what did you look at that brought the headline right out of that conclusion?
Yeah, so a simple way to think about the American dream is if you're a child growing up in a low-income family, say in the bottom fifth of the income distribution, what are your chances of making it to the top fifth, of climbing out of poverty, reaching, say, the upper middle class? And it turns out in America, your odds of making it from the bottom fifth to the top fifth are 7.5%. So 7.5% of children born to those low-income parents make it to that top fifth. In Canada, in contrast, your odds of making that same jump are almost twice as high as in America. So contrary to, you know, the perception that America is the land of opportunity, your odds of climbing up are actually higher in Canada than in the U.S.
Why is it? Why is it so low, Raj, in the United States?
Well, so that's exactly what we're studying in our research group at Harvard, trying to understand what has led to the fading of the American dream over time. In the past, virtually all kids would go on to have a higher standard of living than their parents did. If you look at kids born in the 1940s and 1950s, something like 90% of them went on to earn more than their parents. Today, it's only a 50-50 shot for kids growing up today, entering the labor market today. Odds are you may not be doing better than your parents did. And so we're trying to understand, is it about neighborhoods? Is it about schools? Is it about access to colleges? A variety of things that play into this.
Well, one of the things I love about the research, your research, at least that which we've read so far, is you not only identify the problem, but in some cases, you've identified a solution. Can you talk about the Seattle experiment and what the determinants were there?
Yeah, absolutely. So in our work, we find that, you know, children's chances of climbing out of poverty vary greatly across cities, across neighborhoods within cities. So, for example, here in Boston, there are sharply different chances of escaping poverty depending upon where you're growing up. There are parts of Dorchester, which are higher poverty neighborhoods where kids, you know, as you might expect, have poorer prospects of climbing out of poverty. But then there are other parts even within Dorchester, like Savin Hill, for example, where you see kids growing up in low-income families there have really great chances of succeeding. So
can I interrupt you 1 second? Do you remember Ayanna Pressley in her campaign when she was talking about taking the number one bus from Cambridge to Roxbury in her district and the life expectancy dropped by decades by the end of the line? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
And that's exactly right, Jim. You know, into health outcomes here, you know, chance of climbing out of poverty. Within a couple of miles, you see big differences in Boston, many other cities across America. And so the question we came with is, we spend a ton of money in the U.S. government on affordable housing programs to try to give people access to those better neighborhoods. We spend about $45 billion a year on various affordable housing programs, the biggest of which are housing choice vouchers, which give about 2 million families rental assistance to rent housing wherever they would like. But here's the puzzle. You find that even when families get this rental assistance, 80% of them are still living in high poverty, low opportunity areas where we think their kids are not going to break out of that cycle of poverty across generations. So we set about to ask, you know, is that because families don't want to move to these other neighborhoods because it's too far from their jobs or their family or other reasons like that? Or is it that there are small barriers they might face in the process of looking for housing where they don't have the information, they don't have the support, maybe they don't have the money to pay a security deposit, maybe landlords don't want to rent to them because dealing with housing vouchers and the inspections and things like that can be complicated. So what we did in Seattle is a randomized trial, a pilot study with about 1,000 families who had applied for vouchers. And for half of them, we said, we're going to give you a little bit of extra support at the point you come to apply for a voucher. We're going to tell you about these neighborhoods where we have seen in our prior work, your kids are going to have much better chances of succeeding. We're going to help you find housing in those neighborhoods, connect you to landlords, simplify the process for landlords and so forth. And what we found was a dramatic impact of that relatively small intervention. It costs only 2% extra relative to the overall cost of the housing voucher up front. And what it did was it moved the fraction of families living in these high opportunity neighborhoods from like 15% in the control group, which didn't receive those services, to something like 55 or 60% in the treatment group. The majority of families are now moving to neighborhoods where we think their kids are going to earn about $200,000 more over their lifetimes because they're growing up in a different environment, because they're going to different schools, because they're connected to different people, and so on.
You know, return to Raj Chetty. Is the term you use navigator? Is that what you use?
Yes.
To describe the support, the people. You know, we've discussed this in other contexts, Raj. I am of the belief, with no research, but just a little bit of common sense, is that navigators are the key almost everything that poor people face. We've talked about it in the healthcare setting, where people, how do I deal with the insurance company? What department do I go to? Can I get another doctor? What are my rights? When you have a social worker or somebody who can be your, quote, navigator. Last night we were at the Pine Street Inn doing an event, and they were talking about how their priority, no longer shelter, it's housing. But that they always need people who are put in housing, who've been homeless for years, need support services, which again, maybe 2-3%, which can be the difference between being dehoused, which I know is not a word, and staying in their dream home. So it's the key to a lot of things for poor people, isn't it?
I think that's a great observation, Jim. I mean, the way I think about, you know, the U.S. government, we often focus on the dollars and cents that we're spending on various programs. You know, how many housing vouchers should we have? How many billions should we be spending on the program? But it seems like in this context and many others, thinking about how you actually implement that program on the ground, how do you get people to actually use those services in an effective way? You can't just take that for granted. I think that really matters a great deal. Now, what's tricky is it really matters who that navigator is. So we were very lucky to work with a nonprofit group where the folks helping these families, they were really into it. They were sending text messages in the evening. They were driving people to these different neighborhoods. They were talking with landlords on their behalf. They were really passionate about doing the work. So the question is, can you get such a motivated set of people on scale? We're now trying to bring this program to many other cities across America, working with the Housing and Urban Development Agency. Can you scale that kind of approach in a way where it'll have...
You're working with HUD on this?
Yeah.
And how is Ben Carson receiving your research?
So one of my colleagues met with Ben Carson
really?
A couple of weeks after we put out the study. I've spoken at HUD a couple times about the findings. Look, I mean, the way I look at it is this. everyone, there's a big debate about whether you want to spend more on vouchers, more on affordable housing or not. Obviously, if you're on the left or the right, you'd have different views on that. But given the amount you're spending, there's nobody who's against doing a better job with the dollars we're already spending. Like, why not do that? We might as well make the program more effective. And so I think there are a lot of opportunities like that.
We're talking to Harvard economist Raj Chetty. You know, you talked about vouchers and housing. One of the things that there's great political divides about, and Republicans are much more for vouchers for school kids than Democrats are, who are basically for giving more money to the schools. But it does make sense when you see we have a METCO program in Boston, which allows inner-city kids to go to school in Lexington and Wellesley, and they do much better than the kids who the Globe just did this.
Newton South
versus going to Brighton High. So it makes me kind of sad to think that what we keep doing in education, and we've just done it in Massachusetts with this new rejiggering the funding thing, is say, well, let's spend more on the schools in Fall River and Holyoke and places that don't have any money to try to equalize it. But I think what you're saying is that may be pointless.
Well, I don't know. I think you really have to take kind of a both-and approach. You can't move everyone. You can't move everybody to a different neighborhood or to a different school. You've got to, the way I look at it is provide people opportunities to choose the best neighborhoods for their kids, like we would all want to. But at the same time, think about how you invest in the places where we're seeing much poorer opportunities at present. And it's not just about putting more money into the schools, as we were talking about earlier. It's about how you use that money. Do you get the most effective teachers into classrooms? Do you create an environment where kids are integrating across different backgrounds? That seems quite important. Often, especially in big schools, you see the lower income kids and the higher income kids, you know, in two totally different tracks. They're not friends with each other. It's not an integrated kind of community. So how do you create that in a better way, in a way that will give people access to networks and downstream jobs and so forth?
Now, Jim and I have been fighting for 20 years about education. One of the things we fight about is merit pay for teachers. You talk about how teachers should be getting a lot more money, treated as, you know, the high-end professionals that they are. But you talk about, I believe you were talking about merit pay for teachers, are you not?
Yes. So, I mean,
well, thank you for being with us, Raj. We appreciate your time.
But let me be clear on what I mean by that. So first of all, I think teachers play an incredibly important role in shaping kids' long-term outcomes. We estimate that if you have we've done a study where we track 2.5 million kids in New York from third grade to adulthood, and we look at how the quality of your third grade teacher ends up affecting what college you go to, how much you earn, things like
that. Your third grade teacher.
Yeah, and so,
I
you
love
know,
it.
That's what you can do with these, you know, the kind of the big data approach to thinking about these questions. And what you find is, you know, a good teacher is worth something like $250,000 or, you know, $1 million for a full class of kids.
One good teacher
for a year, right? And so does it follow from that whether you should have merit pay or not? So first of all, I think what it shows is teachers have incredible impacts. We should be trying to compensate them for the incredibly large impacts they have on our kids. So I think paying more and trying to retain that talent in public schools, you know, lots of those people can get paid much more elsewhere. It's sort of like, can you afford to be a teacher?
Exactly.
We shouldn't be putting people in that position. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to have merit pay, but, you know, going a step further, you might say, in many other organizations, if you've got somebody who's doing extremely well, you want to be, as a principal, able to do a little bit more to try to retain that person.
Exactly.
To hold on to him. And so I think, you know, there's a reasonable argument for trying that, but I think the broader point is, we should be elevating teaching as a profession where we're trying to get and keep the best people.
You know, we had Andrew Yang on with us last week, and no surprise, we were talking about his $1,000 a dividend. What's your take on that?
So, look, I think universal basic income, you know, giving everybody a $1,000 cash grant is in principle a great idea. Financing it is incredibly complicated. And, you know, at some point it's going to have to be phased out to really be sustainable. And, you know, at what point do you do that and so forth? All that gets tricky. So a lot of our group's focus tends to be on how you help people earn more themselves. How do you build that human capital going back to childhood, going back to the neighborhood in which you grow up and so forth? So, you know, how do you sort of teach a person to fish rather than give a person a fish? My own view is that's a more sustainable approach in the long run. But certainly there are a group of people for whom, because of health issues and other challenges, you want to provide that basic safety net.
You know, you did, my recollection, Raj, is you looked at 100-plus programs that are directed at low-income kids in this country and tried to determine where government and the people get the maximum bang for the buck. Where did you end up here? What did we learn?
Yeah, so that was actually a study by my colleague, Professor Nathan Hendren at Harvard, also in our research group, and they did an analysis looking at, as you said, 100 different programs, and asked, you know, what's the rate of return? When the government spends a dollar, where do you get your biggest bang for the buck in terms of increased earnings down the road? And it turns out that programs focused on kids, again, coming back to that idea I was saying of teach a person to fish, those have the highest rates of return. And in fact, some of them have an infinite rate of return in the sense that they pay for themselves, because something like this moving to opportunity program that I was describing, in some cases, you find that the money you're spending additionally to help give these families these services, that would be more than offset by the increased tax revenue the government's going to get down the road when these kids are earning more money. So you actually are not investing anything. You're actually getting money on net from the government's perspective. And so it's programs focused on kids that seem to have that property, programs focused on adults, while they can help bring people out of poverty, and that can be very valuable, they don't generate a huge rate of return themselves.
How much does having a two-parent family determine your odds of growing out of poverty?
So here's an interesting pattern you find. That if you look across neighborhoods in America, the single strongest predictor of your odds of rising out of poverty is the number of two-parent families in an area. That's just a fact. But here's an important thing to understand in interpreting that fact. It doesn't matter so much whether your own parents are married or not. Even if you grow up in a two-parent family, if you're growing up in a neighborhood where there are a lot of single parents, we see in the data that your odds of climbing out of poverty are not as high. So what that shows you is the mechanism is not literally about whether your parents are married or not. It's something about the community. Something
takes
that's
a village.
Getting, exactly. Sure. It's picking up like social capital, what the norms are in the place, things like that.
You know, before you continue for a second, I'm looking at you. We've been trying to talk to you for months. I know you're a busy guy. And when we first were trying to get you, I read something that I hope is not true because I so admire your work. Is it true you've only had one cup of coffee in your whole life? Did I read that correctly?
That I think that's about right.
So how do you? Where does this come from? I'm serious. I couldn't exist on one cup of coffee for a half a day. What do you do?
Maybe I'd be doing better if I drank coffee.
Don't like the taste. Is that what it is?
No, but I'm excited about working on this stuff.
Okay,
excited to see it making a difference.
Okay. Forgiven then.
Well, you know, I don't know what the marriage rate is in Utah, but you looked at Salt Lake City, which is, and all of Utah is fairly Mormon, heavily Mormon.
Yeah.
So how did that, the Mormon church, impact kids?
Yeah. And I recently visited Utah, spent some time visiting the Mormon church, try to understand what they're doing there. Salt Lake City is one of these outlier places where you see great levels of upward mobility for kids growing up in low-income families there. And more broadly, places that have a lot of social capital, takes a village to raise a child, you know, are there other people who are going to help you out even if you're not doing well? Places that have that kind of feature tend to have high rates of upward mobility. And the sense you get talking with folks there is, you know, I lost my job, but then there was somebody who came and helped me right away to get me back on my feet. But very importantly, it's not the structure of we're going to give you a welfare program that's going to kind of sustain you. We're going to actively try to help you find a new job, figure out how to get your kids on the right track and so forth. So you do get the sense that they're really actively trying to push that upward mobility.
So if you were in, as you said before, a neighborhood with a lot of single moms, I'm guessing that part of the problem there in terms of upward mobility is that all the single moms are so stressed out that there's not a lot of opportunity to really have that village kind of thing going
on. That's my guess. My guess is it's basically more of a symptom of what the underlying root structural challenges are rather than a consequence of actually there being a lot of single moms versus two-parent families. So exactly as you put it, that's likely to be a neighborhood with a lot of stress, maybe less resources in the community and so forth. And we're trying to dig into that and figure out.
You know, go ahead.
So because we have limited time, we're going to make you the czar of opportunity for the next couple of minutes, both for the country and for Massachusetts. Tell us, if you could unilaterally, forget politics, spending realities, what are the two or three things most important that our governments could change, state and national, to effectuate a far greater upward mobility outcome in this country?
So let me suggest three things. So first, we find that the growing segregation of America, where we have the rich and the poor living in different neighborhoods, interacting less and less, I think that's a really serious problem. That's leaving a lot of kids behind. And I think as our work in Seattle shows, you can address that issue not through some very complicated set of things, but just changing existing policies in smart ways to create more integration, not just with housing vouchers, but with the way we're doing zoning, with the way we're trying to build public housing, with the way we offer tax credits to developers. There are lots of ways to try to integrate more. That's number one. Second, I think we've got to focus on investing in the neighborhoods that are falling behind. That could be in the context of schools, like trying to retain better teachers, as we talked about. It could be in the context of creating better mentorship programs and networks and community support. There, I think there's more work to be done there, and precisely what works, we're trying to figure that out in our group going forward, but that's the second area. And then the third, which we haven't touched upon so much yet, I think is very important, is access to high-quality higher education. So we find that your environment matters from roughly birth till you're like 23 years old. Throughout that point, the environment you're in is really important, and so naturally after age 18, you're thinking about institutions of higher education, especially here in a place like Boston. And there, the key challenge is you've got a lot of schools here that have terrific outcomes, Harvard, for example, MIT, and so on. But those schools have very few low-income kids, even despite their great efforts to increase financial aid and have more outreach and so forth. So how do we expand access to schools like that for kids from lower-income backgrounds? And how do we improve outcomes at some of the colleges where there are a lot of low-income kids, but we're not seeing terrific outcomes after graduation? I think we can use data. We can be precise about trying to move that forward.
Your work is unbelievably exciting, Raj. I have to say, thanks so much.
A lot of things kind of you tipped over for me that I thought one way, and now I think a different way. Thank you very much.
It's great to meet you.
Raj
Chetty
is the William A. Ackman Professor of Public Economics at Harvard University. He's also the Director of Opportunity Insights, which uses big data to understand how we give kids from disadvantaged backgrounds better chances of succeeding. Raj Chetty, thank you very much for coming in. Up next, Emily Rooney, here for her famous list of preoccupations and proclamations. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Looks like Rudy Giuliani knows what he's going to be for Halloween. A hero. We'll ask Emily Rooney if in these crazy times Giuliani is full-blown delusional, or could he be right? Could he end up being the hero of Ukraine Gate? Then it's time for Ask This Old House. Richard Trethewey and Jeff Sweener are here to preview a new season featuring an extreme makeover, turning a 1940s ranch house into a Dutch colonial revival. Whatever that is, tune in and find out.
Here's a shocker. The brand new Orange Line cars are actually lemons. They already need repairs. The Boston Globe's Cheryl Lane joins for this. What Charlie Baker's vaping ban means for local retailers. Then superfan Callie Crossley explains why she is still down with Downton Abbey. And on our Friday news quiz, stay tuned to find out why Somerville Mayor Joseph Cernatoni is reciting obscure Italian texts. Marjorie Egan, you are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Friday, from the WGBH studio at the gorgeous Boston Public Library.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hi.
Joining us for a famous list of fixations and fulminations and more is Emily Rooney. Emily, of course, is host of Beat the Press, which you can catch Friday nights. That'd be tonight. It's 7 o'clock on GBH2. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marge. How are you?
Well, great. I can't wait to talk to you about Rudy Giuliani,
oh boy,
who's been all over the TV and apparently all over Ukraine, yep, doing the president's business involving looking into Joe Biden his son and Hillary's private server. So,
well, let me start by saying that this is a very sad and tragic story, as you know, because, Jim, we, the three of us, are addicted to CNN at night.
Yeah. We are.
So for the last 10 days, CNN has been pixelated on my cable. Like, I can't watch it. Both the sound and the – just completely a mishmash. I have since corrected it. But I have had to watch Fox.
Oh, that's good, though, in this case.
So I've been watching Fox. And I turned him on the other night. I think I'd been out playing tennis. I got home late. I turn on Laura Ingraham, and he's there. And he's with this guy, Chris Hahn, Democratic operative. And I watched the run-up to it. I was just astounded. And can we just play
here it is. Here's Giuliani on Fox News on Laura Ingraham's show, The Ingraham Angle. He's the guy, he's lambasting, is this guy, Chris Hahn, who's a former aide to the leader of the Senate, the Democratic leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer. Here it is.
You actually usually say incredibly stupid things.
You're a public figure.
Yeah, and by the way, do you have any idea that the State Department...
So then you know the libel law.
Hold on. Shut up, Nora. Shut up. Shut up. You don't know what you're talking about.
Chris.
You don't know what you're talking about, idiot.
I do.
The State... No, you don't. You just lied.
Mr. Mayor, I wish you would stop.
You lied, my friend.
I wish you would stop, Mr. Mayor.
Well, why don't you tell him... Why don't you tell him...
I wish you would stop.
Why don't you tell him to keep his mouth shut so we can tell the truth?
Yeah, Chris, just let Rudy say...
Just keep your lying mouth shut.
That was a very helpful dialogue, I thought,
well,
actually.
Well,
cleared up a lot of things for me.
Laura Ingraham was siding with Rudy, who was completely off the rails. And we've said this before on this show. Something happened to him. I mean, he has really dropped a screw or two somewhere. He's barely cogent. And he had already admitted he had gone to Ukraine. And that's what Chris Hahn was saying to him.
You
just
said it.
That's what you did. And then he's screaming at him, you're a moron, you're a liar. And Laura is basically trying to shut the other guy down, who basically never said a word.
Well, you know, by the way, when you say the lying part, Hahn saying you already admitted it, that came, I think, from the CNN thing you couldn't see with Chris Cuomo,
right,
where Giuliani changed his position within the same interview about what he had done.
Then he gives this absolutely wackadoodle interview to The Atlantic where he's upset. This is what exactly what he said about the whistleblower getting more... people don't think the whistleblower is crazy. He says, this is Giuliani, it is impossible that the whistleblower is a hero and I'm not. I will be the hero. These morons, when this is over, I will be the hero.
He's saying, actually, I'm the whistleblower. How is he, in what universe is he translating this? He considers himself a whistleblower. First of all, a whistleblower usually does things in private. You know, a whistleblower is somebody who doesn't want themselves, generally speaking, to be outed. They often are, and this guy will be too, I'm sure, but, you know.
Well, you know, one thing I don't know the answer to, maybe you two do, when he is taking the position, you know, you heard, for example, Pelosi this morning calling him a rogue actor, and the contention in the whistleblower report and the, at least the implications from the transcript or the summary of the call is he was off there doing his own rogue, quote, diplomacy. He is the president's operative, sort of like the Michael Cohen of 2019 for Donald Trump. And he says he was there at the request of the State Department.
Right.
Has Pompeo or anybody else in the State Department responded to a question as to whether or not they had any knowledge of or involvement in Giuliani's Ukrainian behaviors?
No.
I don't think so.
And we know that the president asked him to go there through the redacted or reconstructed call with
of the call,
Zelensky.
Yeah,
Barr was supposed to help him out in Ukraine, the attorney general, and so was Rudy Giuliani. And there's this kind of humorous thing about the Ukrainians thinking, they don't know whom to believe. They got the people from the State Department telling them one thing, new officials telling the other thing, and Rudy telling them the third thing. And they're
back to Giuliani for a second, though. I'm wondering if, I mean, in some bizarre way, his intense obfuscation, which he does with that just, you know, the yelling and the frenetic presentation may be helpful to the president, because that's sort of in keeping with the kind of logic that the president has. And when you listen to him shouting down those people, and Laura Ingraham, something happened to her along the way too, going along with it, you know?
I mean, yeah, well, I think she's always been a little bit... You know.
Well, by the way, can I get back to your last point, which I think is the most on-point thing we've said? This is not much different than day two of Kavanaugh, when Kavanaugh decided, when I go back before the committee, I have to perform as Trump for Trump when he says to Klobuchar, Senator Klobuchar, have you had blackouts or whatever he said? It was this bombastic, disrespectful, almost manic behavior.
And which seems to be effective.
Well, obviously it's worked pretty well for Trump so far, hasn't it?
I mean, I heard one of your callers not too long ago just called in about Ukraine. They had clearly been listening to Fox over the last couple of days.
Well, yeah. Well, it is the propaganda machine, and they spread all these lies, and they've been very effective at spreading all these lies. But and Trump, meanwhile, is saying that Adam Schiff has to resign because he's been such a disgrace. And you think, really?
First of all, it's little Adam Schiff. Not Adam Schiff, according to the president. You know, speaking of the whistleblower, the New York Times is taking some heat because while they didn't disclose who he or she was, they did disclose that the person worked for the CIA, according to, I think it was three sources. And the guy who runs the paper responded to a lot of criticism that they're putting that person at great risk by allowing the world and the White House, theoretically, to know at least more closely who he or she was likely to be. What's your take on this?
Well, the people who are criticizing are very unsophisticated about the operations of a news department and the fact that the White House not only knew this was a CIA operative, they They also know who it is. So for the New York Times to basically report something that the White House knows, they have not used his name, although my guess is the New York Times knows his name too. They're just reporting a point of fact. And I thought the lawyer for the whistleblower completely overreacted, like somehow this guy was going to be put in harm's way. Well, I mean,
He's in the United States. He's not in Ukraine or Russia or in some
there are nuts out there who do anything to hurt somebody who they thought was hurting the president. But you know, this is sort of like the Jeffrey Wigand thing with the cigarette. I mean, eventually your name is going to be known. There's just no way to protect somebody who blows a whistle at that magnitude. And the fact that you now, even though there are hundreds of CIA operatives, his name will eventually assuming it's a him.
But there's another, is Baquet how you pronounce his
Baquet,
name?
Baquet.
The other reason why I think he, beyond the fact that the White House already was aware, as you said, who he was, the Baquet's argument, which I find to be really important, is the New York Times thought an important issue was the credibility of the whistleblower. And when you say, one, that he or she is a CIA person, and two,
from inside the White House.
Experience in the region.
Yes.
So that the criticism, he or she really didn't understand what they were discussing on the phone call.
It helps buttress his
credibility when the American people are deciding, should I believe what the whistleblower had to say? So I'm totally with the New York Times, too.
I know there was a lot of outrage, and I think there was some outrage in some journalistic circles, too, but I didn't share it.
I think we all agree on that.
I think it would be different if this person were undercover in some area of danger. That would make me feel differently.
The people that are really in danger are low-level employees who stumble on something, who discover something. They're worried for their job. They're worried for their reputation. They're worried for, you know, they think that they're going to get cut, axed, whatever. And they're genuinely reporting something that they feel needs to be brought to the attention.
You know what we haven't mentioned the last couple of days? There was a moment in the hearing, there were so many moments that deserved attention, we didn't give this one, is when McGuire, the director, acting director of National Intelligence, was asked repeatedly, I think by Schiff, the chairman for the most part, is why didn't you do anything publicly? If you believe in whistleblower statute, you believe and support whistleblowers, like you say you do this one, even though you don't have first-hand knowledge of his credibility or her credibility, why didn't you do it when the president called him a hack? Likely a political hack. Why didn't you say something? He said, I wrote an internal letter, and there were a lot of factual misrepresentations out there. I couldn't respond to all of them. The appropriate follow-up question was, well, one factual misrepresentation was coming from the most powerful person in the world, which will discourage all whistleblowers in the future. And McGuire obviously didn't have the courage to do the right thing.
No, D&I. No, nobody in a position of authority, in any secretarial position, no one is who wants to hang on to their jobs, even though most of them haven't, is going to come back and say, no, actually, Mr. President, it wasn't a hack. They're not going to say that.
Well, this person is unbelievably courageous. I love the way McGuire said, it reminded me of George Bush the First. Prudent, wouldn't be prudent, had to be prudent.
Can I say one more thing about this?
Said prudent 15 times.
If I may, even though all three of us are on the side of the New York Times in this thing, I'll make a small argument for the other side. The president in this small gathering, I think of 50 people yesterday, is reported to have said, compared the sources for the whistleblower to spies. And he said, you know what we used to do to spies? The implication being, you know, we execute these people, do this sort of things. When that message ultimately gets out, again, to the nuts out there who will do anything they think they're doing on behalf of their guy, there is a risk proposition, and I'm assuming the New York Times balanced that with what they believe is the Post.
Look at the risk to AOC or these congresswomen that have been called out as the squad. There isn't a risk to them. I would be a little concerned about people going over off the deep end.
I think they are,
and they rightly are.
Can we move from the something much more important than the future of the country? Can we talk about the Patriots for a couple of minutes? We discussed this briefly with Trenny Kuznarek on Tuesday, and we've discussed this ad nauseum with you in the past, but I am obsessed with the way the greatest coach who ever lived, Bill Belichick, treats the press. And you've heard this 1,000 times, all of you out here, but let's play it one more time. Here is an exchange between a woman by the name of Dana Jacobson for CBS and Coach Belichick, I guess, on Sunday. Here it is.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what was the final straw with Antonio Brown?
Yeah, we're focused on the Jets today.
Thank you, Coach.
And following the thank you, Coach, besides no thank you from the coach, is what is being described, I think appropriately, as a death stare by Coach Belichick. At this report, yet another example of him treating reporters who have a job to do with totally reasonable questions like total garbage.
It is a story that I'm going to address tonight.
Oh, good. And, good.
I interviewed Ben Bolan, who's the NFL reporter
for the Globe,
for the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
Very thoughtful. He goes to all those. I mean, I asked his questions, that, you know, like, why do you go? And he said, well, because you don't want them to win. I said, that's a funny one because that's the kind of thing that Coach Belichick would say. But he actually turned my head a little bit on the interaction with Dana Jacobson. He said, you know, I went back and looked at it. And the coach was stunned that she didn't ask a follow-up question. So when she said, thank you, coach, and he kept looking at her, I think that he thought she was going to come back. Because most people press. When he said, I'm on to the Jets, he figured she wasn't going to let it drop. And then I looked at it again and I thought, you know, He could have been right about that.
Well, I heard that, but you know, normal people, when someone say thank you to you,
they
know what you say
you
in return?
Yeah, I know.
Thank you, and you walk away. Yeah,
and it's not the first time. I went back and looked at 1,000 clips of Belichick, and this is not the first time the term death stare has been used. But like Giuliani and Laura Ingram, I mean, I think he's just gone one step. He's like he's left a screw on the ground somewhere. I mean, he treats the press with such contempt. Now, the press, you may not like them, but they are also the conduit to all the regular people and the fans. And the fans have a lot of the same questions that the media has. They're not all about, you know, why'd you make that play at 4th-and-1? They want to know personal things about why you signed Antonio Brown, why you didn't play Malcolm Butler. It's like these are legitimate questions that, you know, more than just the sports media are asking.
We never got an answer to that Malcolm Butler question.
No, never did.
No, but let me just say, to be clear here, I would like to get an answer, and I think the public is entitled, because even though I said this the other day, even though the Patriots are obviously a private entity, they're a public part of our lives. Well, my problem with Belichick is not the failure to answer. My problem is the gross disrespect.
Yes.
If you don't want to answer the question, you don't answer the question. You're entitled not to answer. I don't like it. But treat people who are doing their jobs responsibly like respectful, equal human beings.
He cannot do it.
He cannot do it, and it really drives me.
And it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. I think he would have done the same thing to whoever it was.
I agree with that. So we are, okay, fine. So we're in agreement on that. We can move on. Let's move on to why Emily really is here every Friday.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
So is it impeachment list?
Or
what? It is.
Oh,
I didn't know that.
Good. Shoot. I knew Jim, and Jim is probably, so I didn't know a lot of this. It's not really a quiz, but it is like a question.
Okay.
It's a Q&A.
Yeah.
I didn't know a lot of this.
Okay.
So I just want to preface that.
Okay.
I knew answers to some basic things. So, number one. Impeachment is equivalent to what in the court system?
Indictment.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Very good.
Oh, I mean,
he's going to do very well.
Yeah, he's
okay,
going to do very well.
Now.
I won't do
I'm
well.
I'm so proud of myself. How are I got that one right.
So, first of all, impeachment didn't come into effect until, I think it was 1879. So it was after, well after, you know, the Constitution and all that. Actually, no, it wasn't that
I
long.
Didn't
but
know
it was
that.
A long time after the actual Constitution. But how many federal impeachments have there been since it was put into position?
There was Johnson.
No,
Nixon.
No. Federal, forget.
You mean judges
I didn't
and
ask
everybody?
About, yeah.
Oh, in of judges and stuff?
Everybody.
I'd say
oh,
under 10.
I have no idea.
How many?
19.
That wasn't wow. under 10. I
didn't no, know. Not under
so
10.
So are they mostly judges?
Yes. A total of 15 judges, including 13 district court, one court of appeals, one Supreme Court justice.
Oh,
do you know
what,
who that was?
No.
What did the Supreme Court justice do?
Come on, Jim.
I don't know. Who was it?
I'm going to tell you what he did. Samuel Chase. He was impeached for political bias and arbitrary rulings. It's like, okay, arbitrary
okay.
rulings.
It's not very enlightening.
If a president is impeached, who presides over the Senate hearings?
The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
But before you go to that,
God, you're really
is the
doing,
most
I don't know
recent
any of this.
The most recent judicial impeachment and conviction
I got
was of
that.
The kind? Oh, you're going to get to that? Okay, yeah. Fine. Okay.
How many presidents have been impeached?
Okay, I don't know this one. That, well, actually impeached?
Yes, impeached.
Like convicted in the Senate?
No,
no
impeached.
That's not in,
okay.
impeached.
Impeached is Johnson, Nixon, Clinton, and now is it, this is
no, I think
just
it's two.
An inquiry.
It is, oh, sorry. Sorry.
So this is just an inquiry. So I guess it would be three.
Two.
Nixon.
Yeah.
Oh, he retired.
Dropped,
he resigned. He resigned.
So it was just Andrew resigned. Johnson and Bill.
Does Clinton. Marjorie get to do a second answer? No, you only get your first answer. It's the only one that counts.
Yeah, okay.
So I want to be clear.
How many cabinet secretaries?
Has Ben Carson been impeached yet, or has he not? Now, I'm just asking. Now, I have no idea. I didn't know any had been, actually. Who?
Did I?
William Belknap, the Secretary of War in 1876 for graft and corruption.
Wow.
I love those vagaries, don't you?
I love that.
Graft and corruption.
Was he dumped? Or,
oh, yeah.
Or was dumped? Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Now, these are people that are...
Gone, okay.
How many... 19 people total that were impeached and then
and
tried in the Senate and convicted.
Okay.
How many U.S. senators?
No idea.
Did John Tower get impeached?
No.
Remember him? Remember him?
Was he the dancing...
He was, I think, grabbing a lot of women when he had too many cocktails.
What's the answer to that one?
One U.S. Senator, William Blount from Tennessee,
never heard
for
of
conspiring
him.
To assist Britain in capturing Spanish territory. That's
what?
Pretty sophisticated.
I think that
wow.
is, that's an impeachable offense.
How about the guy that was carrying on with Fannie, what's her name? The
oh,
stripper.
From the Fannie Fox
Fannie
was her
Fox.
Name. Yeah.
What was his name?
No, he was a member of Congress.
No,
he was the
he
Speaker
retired.
Of the House. He was the Speaker of the House.
All right, I can't believe we can't remember
I can't
his
think
name.
Of his name. Can someone tell us what that is so we're not humiliated, please?
Yeah,
thank
I'll try
you.
I'll look it up here.
Yeah,
Fannie
go ahead.
Fox.
I think he's from Texas, but I'm not sure. Or Oklahoma. Well, whatever. Go ahead.
Okay, so William O. Douglas was twice
Wilbur
impeached.
Wilbur Mills.
Wilbur Mills, that's
Fannie
right.
Fox.
Twice impeached, but never convicted. Twice, though, William O. Douglas. For what?
I don't know.
This is really pretty interesting.
Supreme Court, for those who are not paying attention.
This is great. Number one, giving Julius and Ethel Rosenberg a brief stay of execution.
Wow.
He was being impeached
for that,
but not convicted. Number two, failure to recuse himself on an obscenity case while publishing articles in Playboy magazine.
Well, that is impeachable. That is a real problem. Doesn't his former wife live right down the street, by the way?
Yeah.
Doesn't she live
Kathy,
like five
she lives
blocks
in, on
from
Beacon
here?
Hill.
Yeah.
Wasn't she like 50, I see her, you
wasn't
know, fair
she
amount.
Like 50 years younger than they?
She was.
Yeah.
She was a lot younger.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I mean, good for him.
I actually
no,
met him when I was one.
No,
I met her,
did
too,
you?
But yeah, and when I was in Washington.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, his granddaughter's age.
Yeah.
No, well, you know,
she's in her
that.
Early 70s.
They were into each other. They're in. I mean, that's really. I mean,
he's
I don't
remarried.
Like
you were
all.
So full of baloney. If it were turned around and Nancy Pelosi was dating somebody 20,
it'd be an outrage.
What would you say?
An outrage.
Thank you very much.
All right,
then
here
I
we
did.
Go, Jim, to
I'm
your
sorry.
Question.
Yes.
Who was the last person impeached and what year?
I think his name is Hastings or something, and he's a judge
very
from Florida, right? Is that right or not?
No, but you're right. He was
who
impeached.
Is he? Who
Judge
is
he? Thomas Porteous,
oh.
Eastern District of L.A. for making false financial disclosures, convicted in 2010.
Oh, I didn't know.
I didn't know anything.
Financial disclosures.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my list.
You know, somebody
that
else
was excellent.
That
was really
excellent.
Fun, by
I didn't
the way.
Know anything.
It was really fun. Okay, what are you doing tonight? Well, we know, okay, Parr. What are you doing tonight on
the way, Beach? By the way, before you move away from this, so all those hearings we saw with Nixon back in the 70s, they were just the preliminaries. Okay, they
never
were preliminaries.
Never got anywhere.
Okay, they were great hearings.
I mean, he would have been impeached, but...
No. And he resigned.
He resigned in August, right?
He had a sense of shame.
We got to do Bill Belichick because the video itself. And then I went back and looked at all those press conferences. I mean, it's not like he hasn't had this pattern in the past, but it's definitely, he's upticked his game a little bit. We're doing a piece on this this guy who did the crowd gathering. That he held up a sign, said, you know, Venmo me money for my beer.
Oh, yes.
But then he raised $1 million and he gave the money to charity. And Anheuser-Busch was in on the thing. They were you know, equaling the money that he raised and giving the money to charity. And then this reporter from the Des Moines Register goes back and starts investigating this guy and finds out at age 16 he made 2 racially charged tweets. So suddenly the whole deal falls apart. The Anheuser-Busch backs out. It's like, really?
Carson King, right?
Turns out the reporter who undug this also had made some questionable tweets. He got fired.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
So it always raises the question, how far back is it legitimate to dig into junior high school?
Do you know what the tweets were?
They were pretty bad.
They're pretty bad.
One compared African-American to women to gorillas. I mean, they were bad. Yeah,
okay.
They were bad.
Okay, what else?
And then this is really interesting. So MSNBC and a couple of other networks carrying that rambling press conference the other night, mm-hmm. MSNBC stopped in the middle of the press conference, said, I'm sorry to do this, but we can't go on. What the president is saying isn't true. And a number of other networks were doing commentary while he was speaking, saying it isn't true, but they were the only ones who just dropped out and said, we can't go on.
That's a great topic, actually.
And, it really is a conundrum for networks going forward. How do you give somebody a forum, even though it's the president of the United States, a forum to say anything he wants in any rambling fashion when 50% of the least of it is not true?
Emily, it's great to see you. Right. Great list, as
see
always.
You guys. Thank you very much,
tonight.
Emily
Thank
Rooney.
Emily Rooney.
Emily joins us every week. Of course, you can keep up with her Friday nights at 7 o'clock right here on Channel 2 for Beat the Press. Emily Rooney, great to talk to you. Up next, it's time for Ask This Old House with the show's Richard Trethewey and Jeff Sweener, taking our questions and your calls. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Mardrigan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. This Old House's season premiere is next Thursday, October 3rd, on WGBH-TV at 8 p.m. It kicks off with the Westerly Ranch House in Rhode Island. Project entails transforming a 1940s ranch into an updated Dutch colonial, whatever that is. We're joined by Richard Trethewey and Jeff Sweener. Richard is the plumbing and heating expert for This Old House, and I ask This Old House. Great to see you, Richard,
nice
as
to be back
always.
With you guys.
Jeff Sweener is back, and he is still the president and CEO of Sweener Builders. Jeff and his team are behind the ranch transformation. Jeff, it's great to see you again. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
Now, can we start at the end?
Sure.
Oh, I don't want to give away the suspense, but are we allowed to say last night was the...
Yeah.
The what you call it party down there in Westwood.
You were missed. You were invited and you were missed.
And
maybe
the listeners don't care very
we
much.
We had to go someplace else.
We care. Were you serving the lamb chops or were you not?
They were beautiful baby lamb chops, yes.
Did you bring any with you?
No, they had your name on it.
But we didn't.
We did not bring it. They don't travel well.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine.
But we know you were at a good event.
We were at a good event, that's right. We were at a Pine Street Inn event, and it was a wonderful event.
Yeah.
But, you know, Westerly, Rhode Island is one of my favorite places in the world. We just stopped at the hotel, the summer house, and
the ocean house.
It's absolutely gorgeous. So I'm dying to know about this Westerly home with a view of the ocean.
Yeah.
You want to tell us?
Well, interesting. I kind of got a lot more of the history than I knew last night at the wrap party, some of the neighbors. And the story goes that 4 buddies that came back from World War II bought this piece of land collectively and subdivided it into a little enclave, and they all built their own houses. And at the time, at that point in time, there was absolutely a clear view to the ocean. Oh, so there wasn't
before the trees
tree.
Grew up. Exactly. And knotty pine, yeah. I guess,
oh my
was...
God.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
It's coming back. Knotty pine.
Well, you took it all out, though, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I kind of have a soft it, spot for knotty pine, because yeah. it's all over the Cape houses,
right.
too.
Yeah.
But nobody likes it anymore.
Nothing says the 50s like knotty pine.
So, Jeff, I would embarrass myself by saying I didn't know what a
and
Dutch
Studebaker.
Colonial Revival...
And Studebaker.
And the Edsel yeah. was huge,
yeah,
too. But
that's right.
What is a Dutch Colonial Revival?
Everybody wears wooden shoes.
what is that?
Well, it's... the house started as a typical ranch, and the owners wanted a little bit more space. They wanted to go up to a second level. So when you go on a second story, then you have the choice of either... a colonial, which would be, you know, vertical walls with a roof, a cape, which would be angled walls with dormers. But a Dutch colonial has what's called a gambrel roof, which is actually two different pitches to the roof line. So you get a little bit more use of the second floor.
Now, Richard, when you were making hand motions, when Jeff is speaking...
It's
you were
radio.
Aware that on
it's
radio we do
radio.
Not have pictures.
But I was trying
you know
to, I was trying
oh,
to make
me,
you smarter.
You're doing that.
I've yeah. worked with you before, Jim.
That's right. I make a lot of hand motions. I can't help
we
it.
We need crayons.
So are there 12 episodes on the Red Line? So what do we learn on next Thursday and the following couple of Thursday? What are we learning?
In show one, it's always you identify the property. You get to meet who the new owners are there and sort of go through each aspect. You know, what we're going to do to the building. We had such fun doing this opening scene. We did a play on the word westerly and western. So the producer says, you know, put on chaps and put on cowboy outfits. So Tommy, Kevin, and I are there, and we open the scene with me going, you know, do these chaps make me look fat? And Tommy says, the burritos do. Right? Kevin's dressed as Clint Eastwood, and all of a sudden Jeff drives up in the car and says, I didn't say Western, I said Westerly.
I said a ranch.
Ranch
in Westerly.
So we had fun with that.
Okay. So Jim has a pair of chaps.
Yeah.
And now you're going to say mine don't have a back. Marjorie, that's an old bad joke. We're not going to get into that. By the way, we're going to take your calls in a couple of minutes. At least Jeff and Richard are. And they do not have to all be on what Marjorie wants to talk about.
Don't
she does
do
every
it.
Year.
I'm not going to
no.
do it.
Don't do it.
I'm not going to do it.
It is the no ice dam zone. Other than that, anything else, 877-301-8970. Any questions you have for these two guys? You know what I wanted to ask you about? A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about a campaign. You're a plumber kind of guy, Richard Trithewey.
Yeah, plumber kind of guy.
Are you aware of the Make Dishwashers Great Again campaign?
No, Jim.
Are you really not aware of this?
Tell me about it.
Okay, so there is great concern by dishwasher manufacturers that because of efficiency rules and those sort of things that Obama and others put into place, that instead of the average dishwasher cycle being roughly 60 minutes, it is now more than 2 hours,
yeah.
And they're appealing to the appropriate regulators. This is a serious campaign.
Sure.
In the Trump administration to, quote, make dishwashers great again by allowing them essentially to make inefficient use of water and electricity, but speeding up the yeah. dishwasher cycle. So which side are you on, Richard?
Well, I don't really know.
Uh-huh. I'm glad you're taking
I'm
a stand
sure.
on
this
an important
is where
issue.
I am politically.
Yeah, you know, but you do notice with the new dishwashers, because I do have a new dishwasher.
I just got a new
so
one, too.
You,
yeah.
That they do take longer, but you know what?
Life is good. You guys getting new dishwashers.
Yeah, life is good. They don't make any noise.
Yes.
They make almost no noise, yeah. and so what if it takes 2 hours?
Leave them on for 3 hours, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They take up they have the Energy Star thing on them. They take up a lot less electricity. So
right.
It's like refrigerators, right? The new refrigerators are much better, right? Yeah. So your electric bill is lower, right?
The bigger change was in the old days, you had to leave the hot water in your house turned way up in order to get it. And then in the late 80s, I think it was, dishwashers all had an electric element at the bottom to heat cold water. It doesn't need to have hot water. So that means they save. That was one of the energy savings.
I didn't
savings.
Know that.
Sure, it has a heater down at the bottom so that you can heat the water and get it up to a sanitizing level.
So we're talking to two guys from this old house who just finished this westerly thing, Jeff Sweener, Richard Trithewey. Before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970, is this your third project with these guys? Is that right? Am I counting right? How many?
Four,
whatever it is.
Still takes our calls.
How did you find this guy? I'm talking to you.
It was who? You, me.
How'd you find
we
Jeff?
We got lucky. We had a friend down in that South County, Rhode Island, and the word was that Jeff was the real deal, and he is. He's got designers on staff. He's got great people. He had done one project after another. He's organized in terms of how to manage the project using a computer and some of the stuff that us older folks hadn't figured out how to do. And he's got all kinds of young people coming into his company, so it tied in with our Generation Next. We did one project that came in perfectly on budget, perfectly done. And we're kind of in love now.
Before we do jump to the calls, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Yeah. You described, I think it was you and Kevin, I'm not sure, described as this Generation X thing. Is that what it's called?
Next,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Describe what you guys, I love this. Describe what you guys are doing.
You know, the Votech schools became almost a dumping ground in the late 60s when the word was you can only take a liberal arts path and go to work for the insurance company of Ma Bell. And we're missing a generation of people. Now we've got the average age in all of the skilled trades is 50 and 60 years old. We're missing a generation. We're trying to win that generation back now by showing that there's a viable career you can have in welding and carpentry and electrician and plumbing and heating. And it's making a difference. We don't know. It's not something we can track as well as we'd like to. We put a lot of effort into it. Yeah. We hear great feedback on it where, you know, parents want their kids to be, you know, have the right choice. But sometimes the right choice is exactly to work with your hands or to do something very tactile.
I think it's great. I'm serious. I think it's just fabulous. Yeah. You guys, should we take some calls, gentlemen?
Sure.
Lisa in Boylston, you are first on with Jeff and Richard from This Old House. Hey there, Lisa.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
So I actually met Richard a number of years ago.
I'm sorry.
At where?
Yeah, and we bought some fireplace bricks or something from you. But I have a question because we have a
Lisa.
Lisa.
Oh,
what's
Lisa.
Your question?
Yes.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So we have a fairly new home, and we wanted the builder to do the basement for us, and then towards the end, he said he wasn't going to do it. So now I'm forcing my husband to do it. And we're wondering about, so it's a walkout basement, and there's a lot of framing already there with some insulation. But we need to put insulation on the cement, like the foundation. And I'm just wondering what you recommend, because there's a product out there that looks like these foam things that I'm hoping you can just like glue up there. But my husband is like, if we do that, we would still need to do like 2x2s or something. Is your advice in insulating the foundation to finish a basement?
So look up a product called InsoFast.
Yeah.
It's InsoFast.
And it's fast. It's really fast.
It's insulation and studs in one. It has raceways and chaseways for plumbing and electrical. And it's really a nice solution.
Yeah, yeah.
It goes in fast.
Is that a do-it-yourself kind of thing that's real for her husband or no?
I would say yes. Yeah. Yeah, I would say.
So, Lisa, before you go, was Richard selling bricks out of the back of his car or what? He's a plumber and a heating guy.
I don't think I've ever
sold
a fire brick.
Not a mason, but whatever.
No, they were these totally compressed, like, wood.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Do you really mean yes or no?
Yes, no. We,
and you were cooking like burgers or sausages.
That's right. So
you were cooking burgers and sausages.
I'm part of a startup of where this brilliant carpenter contractor from the Cape took all the shavings from all of his workshops and found this machine that could press it into a beautifully burning log for Green Mountain fire logs. We call it now. It used to be called Cape Cod fire log. Uh-huh. And so. It's one thing I do in my spare time.
Lisa, it's great to have you reunited. Yeah. Thank you very much for your call.
We'll sit around the campfire, Lisa, later.
I thought she was going to say she met you in a bar.
No, I don't drink during the day anymore.
877-301-8979. Okay. Jeff Sweener and Richard Trithewey from This Old House.
Jeffrey from Andover, thank you for calling.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Richard, I have the classic plumber's lament.
Oh, no.
I have an upstairs bathroom with no vent fan in it.
Yep.
I have no soffit under my gutter. I have a brick exterior wall and a slate roof. Right. Is there any way I can put a fan in that bathroom?
Is there any way to go downward through a closet or through a chase? Because we could put a remote fan somewhere else and just try to get a 3-inch or 4-inch flexible duct up somehow. You know, you can put the fans very remotely if you can't go out the logical place above or to the side. You can't go out through the side either. You don't want to affect the facade of the brick, right, through the sidewall?
Yeah.
Is there any closet that lines up with anything below? Any place in that room that you can think outside the norm and go down through the building?
I could go down to like the basement, but that wouldn't work, would it?
Sure. Yeah. We have remote fans for kitchens or for whatever that can be great distances away. We can have as much speed or power as we need.
But it's still got to get it to the outside.
Yeah. But
so
if it gets
somewhere,
to the basement,
you've
got to
penetrate the sidewall or the roof.
But if it's in the basement, at least we can find a way. I think we need to get outside the building.
You know, Jeffrey, okay, if you want, I'm glad you called. But if you want direct, you know, person-to-person advice, Richard is selling bricks this afternoon. Is it in Brighton at the GBH headquarters?
No.
Does that answer your question, Jeffrey, or no?
You just got to find an exit point.
Right start, yeah.
Yeah. You need an exit point from the box, but you don't have to think conventionally where it can only be up in the ceiling. We can put a remote fan somewhere in that building. Just have to get to outside.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Here's an email from Margie. I need a new roof. I have shingles guaranteed for 35 years. It's been only 15 years. Ooh. What type of shingles are long-lasting and somewhat green?
Jeff has
problem.
Brick shingles that he sells.
On the side.
On the side.
35 years seems like a long time for shingles to last.
Really?
I don't know. You guys know.
I think, you know, they make shingles for you know, 20, 25, 30, 35, and they even do lifetime warranty. So it ends up being a thicker shingle, so there's more wear surface on it. So a 35-year shingle should last a whole lot longer than 15 years. There's something else going on.
Yeah.
Pulled a fast one, perhaps?
Well, maybe the underlayment isn't correct. Maybe there's some moisture problems getting up the underside. Maybe the roof isn't vented. There's got to be some extraneous contributing factors going on there.
So her question about what type of shingles may not be the question.
Well, because if there's a problem that's causing those shingles to wear off faster than they should, no matter what you put on, it's going to... You know, it could potentially happen.
I know what you can answer that question literally and say, you know, talk about architectural shingles in 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
But the most important thing is if there's something causing this one to go bad, why put it on again and have the next one go bad?
Right.
So
you don't just see all the time now that people don't, when you see these new houses rebuilt, they're almost, a lot of them I see anyway in Brookline, they're rebuilt with all the fake stuff, the fake clapboards and the fake that siding, which still looks fake when you get close to it, but it looks pretty good from afar. So is that the trend? Not have to worry about shingles and stuff
anymore?
Well,
I'll weigh in on this, what you call fake. I think hardy plank and some of those clapboards that are made out of cement are spectacular as far as a stable product. I think the AZEK PVC trim that looks like clear number one pine is amazing. You know, some of the stuff that people consider fake, there's even a slate that we did at Tommy Silva's brother's house that the Historical Commission was giving us all kinds of grief, and they came up and said, "We're really glad you use slate."
Right.
And he says, "Well, it's made from actually tires and baby diapers."
But so I shouldn't call it fake. So it's really good stuff, and you never have to paint your
composite
house again.
And all the historical commissions are having issues with balance, and you know, here's this thing that looks just like 1x6 clear pine, beautiful, that's made out of PVC, and here's this thing you're going to have to paint every other year. That's historic. There's got to be a meeting of the minds between those two, and I think it's getting better in most cases.
But you know what? Interesting that, you know, years ago when all of a sudden we had to go to plastic bottles, right? So now we have all these plastic bottles. Now we got to get rid of plastic bottles.
Right.
So I wonder if the same thing's going to happen. Yeah. Everybody wants to go to vinyl, and you've got all of these synthetic materials, and then, you know, I think wood will come back.
Because of the oil used in the synthetic materials?
Yeah, the oil and the waste, you know, disposing of it is an issue. Yeah. Okay. So I think that the evolution will become
to renewable.
Faster growing trees.
Renewables, yeah.
You know, and the harvesting of trees. Yeah.
That's the voice of Jeff Sweener.
That's very interesting.
He and Richard Trethewey from This Old House are with me. Don't touch my sandwich, Richard. You know, in terms of things aging
just
out.
Just one little bite.
He's
so cheap.
Can we talk about evolution, too? I don't know if we've asked you this before. I think we have, but we've gotten a lot of questions about it every time you guys are here. solar panels and about the evolution of solar panels. Over, I mean, a lot of people I know, and I'm, by the way, I'm in this category. I shouldn't say like Marjorie when she pretends it's her cousin calling about ice dams when it's actually
right.
her.
Yeah.
I was really concerned about doing the solar panel thing after I had an analysis, even though they said you're probably, and you have enough exposure that you could do it, that they're changing so fast that you invest a ton of the solar panels.
For electricity, right?
Yes, for electricity, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. And you spend the money, and essentially they're out of date, like, the day after tomorrow. Right.
I mean, they're getting better. The level of efficiency used to be, you know, like 5, 10%, and now they're up, they're getting closer to converting more efficiency, you know, one for one.
But they're still evolving.
I'm going to stop you there.
Okay.
Solar is one of the few things that have got consistently better for a more attractive price. It's gotten better this way, you know, going into efficiency while the cost per watt has gone down, down, down. And it used to be you put up this string of them and they were all like Christmas lights, and if you had one panel go because a stone hit it, they all were gone. And then they've switched since then to things called mini inverters, where each one is an independent unit. So if you knock one down, and that's where it's happening. I don't think there's any reason not to do it. It's still, you know, you want that stuff to pay itself back within 5 to 7 to 10 years. The financing is so attractive, you almost can't afford not to. And I don't think there should be a commercial space, flat roof commercial space, in the United States that doesn't have solar electricity to offset the use of refrigeration and stuff like that in all these stores, you know. So it's here.
So this old house season premieres next Thursday, October 3rd on WGBH, 8 o'clock. Again, it's the Westerly Ranch House on its way to becoming a Dutch colonial revival. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Let's go to Terry in Cambridge. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question's about water heaters.
Well, that's for Jeff.
Okay, right. I thought there was a
there is. We're only kidding. He's a wise guy.
No, he is. Go ahead, Terry.
Okay. Well, my case is a six family, but I think the same question would be for any homeowner. You know, the old-fashioned white water heaters seem kind of inefficient, and I was wondering what they'd recommend, you know, if you have to change them out, what's a better way to go? I've been thinking of the, you know, they have these stainless steel tanks that work off forced hot water, like Superstore.
Yep.
But I was wondering if the on-demand types. I tried one once, and Cambridge has, water with a lot of minerals in it.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you would recommend a on-demand type system.
I wish I had a dollar for every time I've had this question, because I believe in instantaneous. The idea of having a tank of water with a flame underneath it on and off every hour of the day, 24/7, 365, is only in the United States. It doesn't exist in North America. It doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet. Everywhere else, it's going to be an instantaneous, or what you called an indirect, which means the indirect is a super insulated thermos bottle filled with water. And inside that thermos bottle is a coil that could have boiler water go through it and heat, so there's no direct flame in it, which is why they call it indirect. So that's what most people want in the United States, because there's plenty of hot water without the penalty of operating cost. But the instantaneous, if you can learn to live with maybe only 2.5 gallons a minute for 24 hours in a row, versus having 9 gallons a minute coming out to fill a tub. So I'm a big believer in instantaneous. The fact is, those, even in high minerals, there's not a lot of places for those minerals to stick, so they can operate. And if I was doing commercial, I'd have a series of instantaneous mounted on the wall that could come on as needed to keep up with the building's
load.
You
mean serially, the kind of thing?
Yeah. So.
So you mean the water comes out less forcefully, or less water comes out?
Well, if you have an instant water heater, you're going to heat the cold water at the very speed that you need it. So it's going to, and when they first came out, you were limited to like 2.5 gallons a minute. Now they have the ones that have been more Americanized, has a lot of hot water inside it to mix with some cold water to get you that 120 all day.
Okay.
And so you don't have to suffer like you used to. But I'm a big believer in instantaneous and or indirect. The tank type water. And there's one more thing that we just did in Wester that I want to talk about. If you have to do electric water heaters, a regular electric water heater will go the way of the dodo bird, because it's two or three big elements inside it. So what we showed here was a thing called a heat pump water heater. Conventional electric water heater underneath, but a heat pump on top that gathers all the heat it can find in the basement and in the living space and stores it into the water heater instead of the other way. So, you know, Jeff uses them all the time, and so we should, because down there there's propane is the choice. There's not as much natural gas in some of the rural parts of Rhode Island.
You know, somebody's got a question about oil, and she says, Tom says, ask the guys if they know of options for those with that heat with oil that doesn't have annual contracts. He says he paid way too much last year for his old oil company, and I'm hearing this is happening a lot lately. Is there some other way to, I don't know. I don't know if you, either of you guys know about that, oil contracts.
No, I mean, you need stuff serviced, and so you either need to find somebody to service it or pay a contract to have somebody do it. It's a mechanical device that the burner goes off and on, you know, plenty of times, just like your car. You need car, not car.
I guess you should get a better oil dealer. Okay. Yeah.
Let's take some calls. Frank in Boston, you're on with Jeff and Richard from This Old House, which premieres next Thursday at 8 o'clock, October 3rd. Hey, Frank.
Hello. Can I get two questions in?
Well, ask the second one first, and then we'll see about the first one. Go ahead.
Okay. I've called several contractors, talked to the secretary. They've never called me back. Should I call them back?
What's the question?
Should you call them back?
Should I call them back?
Yeah, harass them. That'd be...
Yeah. Be like Marjorie.
Okay, then what's your other question?
How do I get them guys' numbers so I can hire them?
Oh, these guys?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Well, Boston.
Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
I'm only a Rhode Island guy.
He's only a Rhode Island. Have any recommendations or any advice for this guy?
What
are you looking for?
What's the project?
I got a retaining wall that needs to be completely rebuilt. Goes from a height of 6 feet to 4 feet and a 90 feet in length.
I'll tell you about an emerging trend, because every single contractor is too busy right now and can't find skilled labor. It's the fact of life. It's happening in manufacturing. It's happening everywhere. So what's developed is there's these companies now called like HomeServe and Angie's List and some of the other referral services that you'll have at least a better shot at getting people to come and to give you a, you know, some of the independent guys are already just perfectly happy with their existing client base. They got enough work so that some of these other places will get some younger, more energetic guys and gals that will come out and look at the work. So
Mark McCullough, too.
Yeah.
Mark McCullough's in Boston.
So. Yeah, but he's a Mason. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Our McCullough Masonry, our Mason, we are a rock star of a Mason, Mark McCullough, and he's got a big company in Lexington. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Lexington. Yep.
Frank, tell him that these guys told you to call.
Jeff told you to call.
Okay. Now, before we continue for a second, you know, I love modern stuff. And I don't know if it was you or Kevin or Tom, when you were taking us around the Arlington House, the arts and crafts thing, our favorite feature, Jeff, you may know, was the talking toilet.
Yes. Now, it didn't talk.
Oh, yes, excuse me.
You were talking.
It does something like
that's all you do is
you
talk.
You walk in that the bathroom, true. And it's something like, no, come over here and sit down, or some such. I mean, it is. I mean, was it like the most incredible thing?
It was. And we couldn't get you out of that room.
So. Well, we actually, it'll probably be in the second episode. Where
of Westerly?
We were in
We went to Orlando. Las Vegas. We went to the big show. And
we were shopping toilets.
And? So what's the latest in toilets affordable? Not multi-thousands. What's affordable that's sort of cutting edge on the toilet front?
I think the thing that's changed is you can have a toilet seat you could add to any toilet that will turn that into both a bidet and a dryer, and it's affordable. You just have the only issue is you have to find a way to get electricity near the toilet with a ground fault interrupted outlet. But it's once you live with one of those,
what's affordable?
I think it's probably a
$1,200 toilet.
Is
right?
The seat?
Oh, the seat.
No,
oh,
just the seat is probably $400 or $500, yeah. But it's
worth the price.
I think so.
We have time for one more, and you can pick it, Marjorie.
Let's go to John in Marlboro. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Great.
Quick question. I don't know if you'll be able to help me, but I have a little bit of termite damage on my sill. The question I have is, it looks like it's cosmetic. How do I know if I need to get the whole sill replaced or just, I guess, patch it up?
You're talking about the sill?
Yeah.
Yeah, the foundation sill.
Yeah, you can definitely replace portions of it.
But how does he know?
You basically have to do a little bit of investigation, preferably from the inside where you can access it, and basically just a screwdriver into it, and if it's punky, if it's got a lot of voids in it, then it's got to be replaced. But once you start in the center of it and you work your way out, you'll eventually get to areas that are not affected, and you'll have a much more dense piece of sill there, and that's where you stop.
Good luck with that. Go ahead.
Okay, so I take a screwdriver and I just push into the wood.
Like an ice pick screwdriver, exactly. something that lets you see the density of the wood that's behind it.
Thank you, John, so much for the call. Gentlemen, it's great to see you both. Good luck with the new season.
Really,
we're really excited to
see
you.
It's really fun, and I love going to your wrap party, so I'm sorry.
Yeah,
we'll get the next one.
And I want to congratulate you, Marjorie, that we went this entire stretch, and you never asked us about ice damming.
I've been shamed into it.
Which means she's going to have ice damming.
She's going to have
double
the questions when we come back next time.
Yeah, and it's only September, so next time. We'll be in the winter season. Right.
Jeff and Richard, it's great to see you. Good luck. Thank you very much. Great to see you guys.
This Old House season premiere is next Thursday, the 3rd of October, WGBH-TV, 8 o'clock. Check your local listings. The new season kicks off with that Westerly Ranch House we've been talking about. That's Westerly, Rhode Island, of course. The project entails transforming a 1940s ranch house into an updated Dutch colonial revival. Richard Trithewey is the plumbing and heating expert for This Old House, and as This Old House, Jeff Sweener is the president and CEO of Sweener Builders. Thanks, you guys, both, for coming in. Up next, when did Walmart get a soul and a social conscience? The Boston Globe's Shirley DeYoung joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie, and live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us online to go over the latest local headlines is Shirley Leung. Shirley is the Boston Globe's business columnist and a GBH contributor. Hello, Shirley Leung. How are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks.
Great.
Hey, great to talk to you, Shirley. So your buddy Matt Stout in the Globe had a great lead about, usually the cautious and slow-moving and tortoise-like Charlie Baker, the governor, moved lightning quickly on this vaping thing, banning these vape pipes for 4 months. But he's getting a little bit of blowback from some of the retailers.
Yeah, I mean, it did seem out of character, but when you read Matt's story, you understand that, Charlie Baker is about data. And he also used to be a healthcare insurance executive, ran Harvard Pilgrim, so he knows a lot about, potential health risks and deal a lot with doctors in his former previous life. So I think he made the right call on this. But yes, it is devastating for retailers. I mean, some of them have decided to close rather than wait it out because they're not sure what's going to happen in January. And not only are they concerned about what might happen locally, but what will happen on the federal level? It looks like at the federal level, Trump wants to ban flavored e-cigarettes, and that's a big part of that's a significant part of the business.
I have to say, this is not an area of expertise, but I understand the concerns that the businesses have. I understand the concerns that people like Shailene Title and actually the chair of the Cannabis Commission, Steve Hoffman, was with us yesterday talking about, the potential move to the black market. But I have to say, you've written columns criticizing Charlie Baker, Shirley, for not using his immense political capital. We have too. Since he is data-driven and he believes that data drives you there, the fact that he was the first leader in America to have the courage to have his actions follow his research, I got to give him credit. And my sense is during this four-month period, if they find they overstep their bounds, they'll scale it back. But this is a problem. I don't know if it's an emergency as he characterizes it. And we've all been saying act decisively, and he did. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's better in this case. It's better to be safe than sorry. Especially if vaping is very popular among teens, and so what if this hurts teens? Puts teens at a higher risk than the rest of the population. I think it's. I didn't even think about that. You're right. They put the four-month ban in. If they find that things are, they have a little more clarity, they can always lift it.
You know, one last thing about Baker sort of stepping out where he's usually more cautious is he's also one of the two Republican governors we learned this morning, along with Vermont, who is willing to say that they think an impeachment inquiry is merited. He is not saying the president should be impeached or convicted and removed, but he is, and his counterpart in Vermont, are the only two Republican governors in the country who are willing, at least as of this morning, to go as far as to say that an impeachment inquiry, and it's led by the Democrats, the other party, is merited. So, again, I think that is what you want to see in a chief executive. So
surely the travails of the MBTA continue. We get a bunch of new Orange Line trains
unbelievable story.
This week, and apparently a part of both trains and every door on the 12 new trains needs to be replaced.
So they had to take them out of service, by the way, right away.
So what happened?
You know, as any new product, especially when it's a new train, there are always problems. Didn't they have problems with the commuter rail locomotive engines?
I don't know.
A while back, years ago, yes. I think the engines were made by GE, so and they just moved to town, and so. What can you say? I mean, the MBTA can't catch a break. I mean, at least the red line, you know, the red line's back to normal now.
It
and it's not
That's
even
right.
October. So we can celebrate that.
Yeah.
I was on the train from South Station to Ashmont Station recently. I think it took me 16 minutes at rush hour. I was very excited.
Wow, that's great.
You know, but wait, were you intimating a second ago that, you know, the Orange Line thing is new? Are there going to be kinks to work? If that was your point... My sense is when you order a new subway car, the notion is probably that the doors are supposed to work.
Doors
would you
are
not,
important.
Would you not agree that, new or not, that that should be part of the contract?
They should work, and that's why they roll them out slowly, so they can figure out some of the kinks.
You know, I wish we had asked
Don't
this question of Baker
door.
Last week. Can you imagine being the chief executive of the state when luckily there have not been deaths, but almost on a daily basis... There is another T debacle. It's unbelievable.
Well,
how long till the new Orange Line trains are back on the track? Do we know?
I have no idea.
Well, the good thing is they didn't have to pay for it. The manufacturers of the trains apparently paid for it, not the MBTA. So I believe that's what the story says.
I just hope that the red line cars, when they roll out the new red line cars, I hope they address the problem there. I hope that it doesn't. I hope that they fix them all.
I get
right
far
away.
Inside the train. Once again, you don't want to be near the door, just in case. You know what I'm saying? Remember that crazy story where the door closed and the person they dragged him down?
Happily,
person survived. It was terrible. So Shirley Liang from the Boston Globe, you wrote a great piece about Walmart, and I guess Walmart has decided that they no longer want to be viewed as the evil empire of big chain stores. So what's going on?
So, you know, I started thinking about this last Friday, Walmart had this, to me, felt like a surprise announcement. They were going to ban, they were going to stop selling e-cigarettes because of the, you know, rising concerns from federal and state regulators. This is before Charlie Baker even banned e-cigarettes in Massachusetts. And so they were going to stop selling e-cigarettes. And I was thinking, what's going on? A few weeks earlier, they took a stand on gun control. They said, we're going to lobby Congress, to have more strengthen the background checks. We're going to stop selling certain kinds of ammunition. They'd already stopped selling handguns. Years ago, they stopped selling the assault rifles that you see a lot in mass shootings. And I dug a little deeper, and I found that, you know, Walmart has been, for a decade now, they've been trying to remake their image. It started with Hurricane Katrina.
I didn't know this, yeah.
Neither did I.
Yeah, I didn't know the story. So Hurricane Katrina was 2005, I think, and they have a lot of stores in Louisiana. And when Katrina hit, they were able to get food, water, diapers, supplies to the region, in some cases faster than FEMA. And they got less. And the CEO at the time said, you know, we do this every day. We provide food, water, supplies for people, but we don't get the same press. How can we be that Walmart where everybody has positive thoughts about us or champions us? And so they started, they said, so how do we do this? We do this by going green. I mean, it was like a very intentional move. And it turns out going green is, you know, it's good for their bottom line, but it's also good for saving the planet. And so they've become a leader on sustainability years before a lot of other companies jumped on the bandwagon. And I talked to this author Charles Fishman, who wrote a book about Walmart, and he said he thinks the sustainability kick, or once they got on that train, it kind of planted the seeds for doing good, doing right by their employees and their community. And so that so you start to see, you know, they make more. I thought they had, you know, when I think of Walmart, a lot of us grew up with Walmart. With you think of low wage workers, right?
Right.
You think of really
getting
and
the
shaft. Jobs overseas.
Yeah.
Right. And now they've been good to their staff. They've been, you know, the average wage now is over $14 an hour. Last year, even hourly associates at Walmart have paid maternity leave, I think 10 weeks. A lot of companies don't even have that. I thought that was a really, it was really heartening to see Walmart changing its ways. And as I wrote in my column, it couldn't come at a moment, you know, too soon, because you see, you know, everybody from Senator Warren to Bernie Sanders on the presidential trail saying, you know, there's a financial reckoning that needs to happen. And you know, big bad corporate giants have been, you know, sucking up all the profits and, you know, dollars away from the workers. So, and I think it was good to see that Walmart is trying to lead the way to kind of, you know, to be a better corporate citizen.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that in your piece, the Business Roundtable thing back in August. We're talking about, you know, it's time to redefine what it means to be a corporation. But I wonder, do we have any evidence that anybody else is actually doing it in a big way? I mean, Jeff Bezos gets criticized all the time for treating his workers poorly at Amazon, from the people in the warehouses to the people that drive. Are other people?
No, we are starting to see other companies take the lead on gun control. It wasn't just recently. Another 100, 150 CEOs of major companies got behind gun control. I mean, that was that. You know, a lot of them stayed out of politics, and a lot of them now are, you know, gone on an environmental, social, environmental kick. And so you're starting to see that happen. I mean, I think the question is, how fast will it happen, and how fast will change come about?
Yeah, you know, just two things that are also mentioned in your piece. I'm not sure you mentioned. You may have mentioned one a minute ago. While you did say that they're paying their people better and certain benefits have been improved, they have fought unionization, and
yes.
So what workers there, 1.4 million, I think, are dependent upon their benevolence, which in a number of cases has been there. But they have fought the ability of these workers to be partners at the table. That's a pretty big deal. But on the plus side, I'm not sure you mentioned this, but you do mention your column. It's one thing to be taking certain weapon-related things out of their stores, which I think is a really big deal, and I commend them for. You make the point they're actually lobbying, too. I mean, they're really going the extra yard on background checks and that sort of stuff. So while I'd say it's an imperfect story, it sure as hell is a very different Walmart than those of us used to talk about a decade ago. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and I was, you know, I followed business pretty closely, and I was surprised that to learn that they've been doing this for some time now. And I guess it kind of go I noticed Renee Loft, who was the former editorial page editor at the Globe, she also wrote a very similar column too. So we both noticed this right away.
Before you leave this, I'm assuming, and I'm not, this doesn't question motives, but most businesses do good things, even if it's for the right reasons, because it's a good thing to do, but it goes hand in hand with how it turns out to be good for the bottom line. Have these moves been good for the bottom line of Walmart?
Oh, yes. Going green has. I mean, they've you know, cut their electricity use. I mean, that saves on their, you know, utility bills, and you know, so they, you know, in terms of sustainability, that's been a win-win for them. They, you know, they get points for saving the environment, but they also shareholders love it because they found ways to save money, which means they have bigger profits.
We're talking to Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe.
So Commonwealth Magazine, which is a great publication, they had a piece about how we all want better trains, electrified commuter rail service. We want better transportation, but we don't want to pay for it. So I'm not sure how we get from A to B, Shirley.
Well, this step poll was really interesting because it did signal that people are willing to pay more for better transportation. And I think this poll is interesting because it showed you what they were willing to pay for, what were they willing to do, you know. Overwhelmingly, they did not favor a gas tax, right, which surprised me. And they also did not like congestion pricing either. And they didn't want higher fares for commuters. They didn't want higher parking fees. But they would get behind, some kind of carbon tax on, related to climate change. Perhaps a carbon, some kind of tax on fossil fuels, which is a form of gas tax, but somehow that's more manageable. And so they would get behind a millionaire's tax. They would get behind regional ballot initiatives where people could vote. People of a certain region could vote to raise their taxes somehow to pay for specific transportation projects. And so I thought that was really interesting that people said yes to more revenue, but not everything was on the table.
But I have to say, I had a totally different reaction to this polling. When I used to do tax stuff and well beyond my days of the Tax Equity Alliance, almost always, even in the most anti-tax environments, if you said to someone, are you willing to have a tax raised, even if it wasn't a tax you were crazy about, if you knew that money was targeted to X and it would go there, do you support it, even a gas tax? Overwhelming support for targeted money. What's telling to me about this poll, which is what's really troubling to me, is the taxes that people understand that they would pay, a congestion price or a gas tax, they're overwhelmingly no on. The taxes that they wouldn't pay, a millionaire's tax and a carbon tax, and they probably have no idea what a carbon tax is, with all due respect. Essentially, I am willing to pay those things that I won't have to pay and that I don't think have anything to do with me, and I'm not willing to pay the taxes that may come out of my pocket to have improved service. I think that's a really troubling thing for what is. We had the Senate president here the other day, and she confirmed that sometime in the fall, October, whenever it is, there'll probably be a new revenue proposal, meaning new taxes, on the transportation front. And if this polling is indicative of anything, my guess is there are going to be problems for Beacon Hill and support for Baker's no-tax position, because it's likely to be one of those more direct taxes like a gas tax, don't you think?
I think to me the headline was people don't want a gas tax, and yet you signal from Beacon Hill that and some business groups that is their number one preference,
it is
the gas tax. So you start to see there's going to be a big fight over this, and of how are they going to deal with, and I don't think Governor Baker is in favor of a gas tax, and so it's going to be a real battle on how they raise that revenue.
One last thing, we only have a minute left. What's your sense? Columbia Gas is in trouble again, as they should be. We know that they were responsible for the nightmare of, was it a year ago or a little bit, a year and a week ago? And we know that there was a death and lots of displacement and horrible things that took a long time to undo. And then all of a sudden today, another emergency up there where there's a sort of a massive evacuation. I don't understand in settings like this why the companies that are responsible continues to be the company of record. Do you?
There are not that many utilities out there. So a lot of times they have virtual monopolies. And so, I feel for the towns up there because they must be on edge. I mean, they're, it's pretty traumatic what happened last year, and to have, to wake up and smell gas and then to have another mass evacuation, you're really scared about what could happen. And the NTSB just came out with a report, and they said that they also had a lot of, you know, troubling, you know, they were very worrisome about the record at Columbia Gas. Uh-huh. So, I mean, it really will take the state, really you need the state to act. If they're really concerned about Columbia Gas, they need to find another operator. But I don't know if they're there yet, though.
I want to say one last quick thing about this, and I don't know enough about what happened today. Dan Rivera, the mayor, was incredibly candid. I had him on right after a month or so after this. And I asked him why he partnered with Andover and North Andover, and was it because he was convinced that the company cared less about poor customers of color in Lawrence than they did about wealthier customers in Andover, North Andover? And he said the answer was yes. And I worry, I'm curious to see what the cause is ultimately determined here. Once again, it's one of the poorest cities in the Commonwealth that is the unfortunate recipient of horrible and dangerous service from utility, and I'm curious to know if it turns out it has to do something with the customer yet again. So in any case, we shall see. Shirley, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time, as
Thanks
always.
For having
we appreciate
me.
It. Shirley Young.
Great to talk to you, Shirley. Shirley Young is the Boston Globe business columnist. She joins us every week. She's also a WGBH contributor. Up next, the Downton Abbey movie did not let down. Superfan Callie Crossley. She joins us for that and more on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Before I introduce our next colleague here, we had a call this morning questioning the credibility or the reliability of the whistleblower because it was all second and third hand. Well, CNN is reporting that White House lawyers are admitting for the first time that they did, in fact, direct the transfer of the transcript of the July 25th conversation to a more secure computer, which is exactly what the whistleblower said in his report.
He also said
report.
That this was not the first time that this had happened. There have been other situations where they were so concerned that they moved political things to a supposedly site safe for the kind of things like the plan to take out Osama bin Laden and stuff.
In any case, joining us as she does every Friday is Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie Crossley.
Hello. How are you, Jim? How
we're
are you,
excellent.
Marjorie?
Thank you so much.
I am wonderful. So, you went and saw the movie, and you got to explain to Jim afterwards, too, why it is that
Jim, you're not a fan?
I am. I'm not into the monarchy.
Is featured in this movie. The royals come to Downton Abbey.
Yes.
But first of all, you loved it.
I loved it. It's really, you know, this is a situation where you once again can appreciate good writing. And Julian Fellowes is just off the chain with his writing. I mean, he really is. It's, you know, there are so many characters to move around, and he really knows which ones to sort of bring forward and then put back for a second and then, you know, bring it all together. So, yes, the monarchy is as a plot point, but it's really there to bring the ensemble together and let them work out some other things among themselves. And it's just beautifully done. And it's also beautifully done that he always does a couple of, you know, very serious topics that they are dealing with.
They had the gay kiss.
Well, they had that, and just the whole gay closeted life at that time, and a little bit of foreshadowing, you know, as the characters are, you know, pondering among themselves, could it ever be a time when they could just be themselves? Mm. And it's weird to, you know, watch that. And then, you know, overarching, there's always a class battle. So those long discussions about the class, and then the character who is Irish and his, you know, ambiguous feelings about the monarchy and where does he stand and all of that and how he wants to support the family. It's, I mean, so it's a lot in there for, you know, 2 hours.
It came in first at the box office. It crushed
everybody.
Rambo.
Rambo.
I know.
Ad Astra.
Yeah. And Ad Astra, right?
Yeah.
That's with Brad Pitt.
So, yes. So you're into the royals, though, too, right?
Well, a little bit. But, you know, but I just, this, from the beginning, the writing and the whole setup of this just really got my attention. And then Julian Fellowes was at GBH more than once, but early on, he was at the station. I got a chance to talk to him and Elizabeth McGovern when she was here, who played the American.
She was great.
See, I'm into the whole thing because it's like escapism, and it's like, you know, imagining life when you had to have 17 forks and 17 spoons and you had to get dressed up for dinner and all these kinds of things. It's just the
the escapism thing.
Did you
and
guys...
I loved Harry and Meghan down in South Africa. I thought that was neat, too.
Let's not get into
baby.
Them. did you guys read Christopher Muether, the travel writer for the Globe's great piece on going to Highclere Castle?
Yeah, that is something, isn't it?
He is... To say he is a groupie is an... you had a sense that he was weeping during the... And Highclere Castle, for those who don't know, is Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
And the real thing. And he went there and it was... You should read his piece.
Yeah, it's great.
It is great.
Okay, Callie Crossley. Yeah. So on a really heartening note, a lot of us remember back in the 1968 Olympics when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists and they were summarily, essentially shoved off the stage. What's happened?
Well, 51 years later, the Olympics are giving them their props. They're inducting them into the Hall of Fame. And as more than one writer has said, our analyst, boy, everybody else is caught up, but here the Olympics finally did it. They expelled them at the time. I guess there was some discussion about whether they should or not, and they decided they would be. It's important to note that this was the 1968 Olympics, and a lot was going on in 1968. And they wanted to make the point about, some of the roiling of the racial tensions going on and the inequities they felt they had to represent. And they took a hit. One won a gold and one won a bronze. And so to stand on that platform.
Courage.
Unbelievable courage.
I tell you, I think I'm too chicken.
Young men, they were very young men to do that kind of thing. I mean, in front of the whole world.
And they've lived with it for all this time. There's been a couple of excellent documentaries about just their lives afterwards. And they've lived exemplary lives. They've gone around talking to kids about, having some integrity and what does that mean and taking risks and blah, blah, blah. So I didn't realize Smith broke the world record in the 200-meter race when he won the gold that year. So that's pretty interesting. And again, it has a little shades of Colin Kaepernick because when they raised their fist, the Star Spangled Banner was playing. So here they are. But the Olympics said, hey, it was the year that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. People were in Vietnam War. Everything else is going on. We realized that we needed to come back and give them their due, and so now they're...
Yeah.
They're
and by the way, for people who are too young to have lived through this, this was a life-altering moment for a lot of people. It wasn't just the courage of these two individuals, and this iconic moment is on your television set from Mexico City. There are a lot of people who have had the courage to do a lot of things in intervening years who cite Carlos and Smith as their inspiration, just two incredibly strong young guys.
I was just moderating a panel over at the African American Museum of History here in Boston,
which is fabulous.
It is fabulous, and there it's an award. It's a book award for a scholarship looking at African American issues in the diaspora. And the guy that won said he was inspired to think more broadly, and he really actually expanded how you look at history because of them.
Is that really
true? He was watching them, and he said, there must be more to this story than it's been explored. And so here he is. I mean, it was just an incredible story.
By the way, can we just say, every time someone brings up that incredible museum run by a former colleague of ours that
Marita
is up
Rivera.
There on Beacon Hill, and most people don't know about it, it is a jewel in Boston that is, if you haven't discovered it, you should. It's spectacular.
It's beautiful, and people should go see.
So Callie Crossley, tell us about Carson King from Iowa.
Okay, well, Carson, y'all were talking about it a little bit
with Emily.
That's the guy that held up the Venmo, the Give Me Some Beer sign with the Venmo, and then people responded who knew, and he got way more money than he thought. And by the time it was adding up to thousands and then, going up to the millions, by that time then Budweiser got into it, or Anheuser-Busch, rather, got into it, and some other corporate entities and said, hey, we'll support this. And he said, this is ridiculous. I'll give the money to the Children's Hospital, which is a grand gesture on his part. And so the story, this was supposed to be a feel-good story, was assigned to one of the reporters at the paper. Now, let me see where he's from.
Des Moines Register.
And in doing really just routine background, he came across these two texts that he had written at 16. Now, one should know that Carson King is only 24 at this moment, so it's not been that long ago. And, called him and said, we're going to report this. And I will give Carson King this credit. He got out in front of it as he could. He held a press conference. He said, I was dumb. I'm really embarrassed. I'm really, really embarrassing what I wrote then. And, you know, I hope it doesn't. The money should still go to the Children's Hospital, blah, blah, blah. But of course, the corporations do not want to be associated with him. Well, at the same time, then somebody did some research and discovered that the reporter assigned to do the feel-good story dug up some stuff in his background, which was also some racist rhetoric online. You know, so there's a couple of things here that I think about that. I know there's a whole question about 16, should we forget it? Well, you know, that's part of their lives. What immediately came to my mind, it wasn't a Twitter situation, but it was a back-in-the-day information situation, was Michael Brown being shot to death and left on the street. And the story that came from the New York Times said he is no angel, because they went back and discovered that he had some, you know, run-ins, you know, petty stuff when he was a kid as well. So, and people were like, really? This is what you're going to leave with? So, you know, there's a lot to, same thing coming up here. Really? The kid was 16. He's just 24. He's recognizing what he said was bad. I say make the rules the same for everybody. I don't think that's going to happen, so that's my point. If you're going to bring it up for everybody.
So what do you do? What do you do if you are a jerk when you're 16 years old and you're a racist jerk and you do these things, and then for whatever happens, you realize how disgusting this was? What do you do?
Well, Justin Trudeau, I guess you say.
That's a very good one.
You know,
he was 29.
I know, and teaching
kids.
People. I think the first thing you have to do is acknowledge. So I'm giving Carson King an acknowledgement. It doesn't appear
to
me.
Well, he knew he was about to be outed, though. It wasn't he unilaterally decided.
But I don't think he's sitting around thinking about stuff he wrote when he was sick, honestly.
Oh, of course.
So
I'm not,
it's not like he's saying, ooh, I hope they don't find it. I really don't think he even thought about it. And that makes a statement in and of itself, I want to say. A very unhappy one, as far as I'm concerned. So here they call him, and he goes, right. Well, you know, now as I look at it, I'm really embarrassed. He didn't say, this is what I really appreciate, if someone was offended.
Yeah.
He did not do that. Yeah. He just said, this is horrible. I should not have said this. I recognize I've moved on. And I think you have to acknowledge it. Now, beyond that, in terms of what should happen, I don't know. But as you know, the reporter got fired.
Yeah,
so
I
it's,
saw that.
It's, you know, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
What should happen there? And by the way, I don't know what the reporter wrote, so I know what the tweets were from Carson King.
I don't know
King,
what the reporter wrote either.
So I can't gauge the horribleness of it. But, you know, listen, the last few weeks we've had nothing but conversations about people who have bad tweets in their past, Antonio Brown. So, I mean, we really got to make some decisions about how it's a holistic part of who the person is. So I think the reporter was right in just doing routine research. You have to determine, but I think you let the readers determine, well, was he 16 and that doesn't mean anything? I think it does mean something, but how the
what person. What if he wasn't 24? What if he was 54? And there'd been nothing. By the way, I don't have an answer to my own question.
Yes.
You said
This is Judge Kavanaugh.
I just pulled up trying to find out how old Kavanaugh was.
Yeah.
Well, Trudeau was 29, though. 29,
right.
I don't care if it's 80 years ago, is not as a little boy.
Okay. All right.
He was an adult, and as you say, a teacher when he was 29. I think that's relevant till the day he dies. Mm-hmm. When you're a kid and you do something like this, 8 years later, it's relevant. I mean, it's a small window. 40 years later, if you've lived a fairly decent, exemplary life, is it still relevant? I don't know what the answer to that
question
is. Well,
you know what I think of a lot of boys at that age doing gay stuff, doing like gay bashing kind of stuff. And
some of them mean it. See, that's the thing about
it. Well, that's it.
So that's it.
Yeah. Or are they just trying to be one of the gang kind of thing? I don't know.
Even when you do that, that foments, you know, what else is out there. I mean, the toxicity just builds on itself. And even if you were never going to act on it, some other people could be inspired to act on it. So it's not an innocent thing where it just lies there and nobody responds to it and you know, it has weight. It has some meaning. The assessment is how much meaning, and I can't really answer that question.
Yeah, I know. Neither can I.
You know. Before we leave this, you know, you were talking about complimenting him for sort of outing himself before the fact. Trudeau obviously had to admit, you know, plead guilty and then go from there. And as you're speaking, I'm saying to myself, well, do you wait till you think you're about to get caught and then acknowledge your sins?
And I, well, nobody would do otherwise. And then I think there's one example in recent Massachusetts political history where someone outed himself before anybody else as a quiz. Who was this candidate for higher political office who published a report on every horrible thing he had ever done, some of which might have been illegal? Marjorie, have your hand raised. Who was it?
Jackie Robinson.
The late Jackie Robinson.
Wow.
The Jackie
sure
Robinson
did.
Report.
He sure did.
About him sticking his tongue down somebody's throat. Yes. Maybe she said he stuck his tongue
right.
down his throat.
And he explained it.
Yeah, he explained how it, right. he didn't really mean it or whatever.
Oh,
all
my
his,
God.
His problems with a bar exam.
Oh,
he went down a list
right.
of every horrible thing that he'd either been accused of or had done.
You are right.
To sort of out himself,
you know,
the Jackie Robinson
I mean,
report.
It didn't go well for
no,
him. But
no.
it wasn't the worst strategy. Remember how he's in the middle of an interview on the radio and he gets in a car accident? You can hear the car accident.
Yeah.
In the middle of the thing,
yeah. In the middle of the thing. But it wasn't
Well,
that.
You also don't remember another thing
he's
that related to us.
Well, but, we have but wait a minute. But you have your long laundry list. Doesn't it mean that each thing on the list is equal to the other? It's not.
No.
So, you know, how am I as the voter, a potential voter, to evaluate that except to say, this is clearly you're trying to tell me all this stuff, so I'll think better of you, but you have not said to me, you know, I've learned something from X, I would never do this again, this is what happened. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know that that was a good
weird
strategy.
Event. I remember
okay,
going to the
Marjorie,
press
wait,
conference.
Wait, wait, wait a second. We have another story.
Where he handed us the
okay.
Robinson report.
Yeah, you have obviously forgotten. What was our experience with Jackie Robinson and our old radio station?
He confessed something to you on the air?
No, he did
I
not.
Don't remember.
We
I don't
had
remember.
We had the only debate for the United States Senate Republican nomination between Scott Brown
mm-hmm.
and Jackie Robinson.
Oh, wow.
The
oh,
problem,
God.
Well, it's a bit of a problem.
I guess
the problem
I blocked
is
it out.
Only one of the candidates,
oh,
Scott
that's
Brown,
right.
showed
that's
up.
That's right. Oh, my God.
We wait 10 minutes. We're on live radio. We finally say, I guess we have to start. He was State Senator Brown
yeah.
at that point.
Yeah.
Let's start talking. Who calls into the show from his car
because oh
he was
God.
A half hour late at Jackie Robinson to ask if he could participate in the debate by phone, and we declined his offer, and as a result,
yeah.
he...
Why don't you tell Callie how you swooned over Scott Brown? Jim,
I didn't
was
swoon. That was,
oh
I was accused
God.
Of that. I never did any swooning.
Swooned.
I treated him fairly
Scott
like
Brown
I treat anybody else.
Scott Brown would bring him a dozen
else.
Donuts every time he showed
maybe
up.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Callie, what are you doing on Sunday night on that show of yours, please?
on Under the Radar, we're doing Latinx Roundtable. We're looking at the trend in a lot of states, but not in Massachusetts, to award restricted driver's licenses to undocumented drivers. This is an ongoing thing. My headphones just went out, so I'll just keep talking.
We're okay.
And then we're looking at whether Hispanic Heritage Month, which we're in now, whether that needs a rebrand. And we're also, of course, looking at there are three now possibilities for Latino candidates to make it onto the city council, two who are running for city council at large and one in District 5 with Ricardo Arroyo, and what that can mean. There hasn't been a Latino city council person for 6 years, and what does that mean? And then the second half, I'm talking to Stanley Nelson. You may know him as a fabulous filmmaker that he is. His piece Freedom Riders, of course, got a lot of excitement for folks. He's just gotten a new film done called Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool.
Oh,
now,
man.
I am not a Miles Davis fan. This is a fantastic documentary, stuff that you didn't know about him. And I really didn't understand the breadth of the man's genius. You do know that he was had some other issues. But it's so beautifully done. And it's the whole of his story, all the ugly and all the good. But it really lets you know that he really was the genius that people thought he was. It's an amazing piece. And you get to hear the music. Kinda Blue, which is an album that he made in 1959, is still the best-selling jazz album ever.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Somewhere in the world, it sells 5,000 copies a week, even now. So
wow.
It's wonderful. It's at the Kindle, and one should see it.
You know, the only problem is when you go to the Kindle, Marjorie's belief is if you're a man, you must wear a beret. So... I don't know if that's true, but that's what she alleges.
Yeah,
Kelly,
that's
it's great
not
to
true.
See we'll be listening on
okay.
Sunday night. Take
all right,
care.
Take
Kelly,
care.
Thank
Kelly
you very
Crossley.
Much.
Right,
well. Kelly Crossy is the host of Under the Radar with Kelly Crossy, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes. Follow her on Twitter at Kelly Crossley. Thanks, Kelly. Up next, it is time for our Friday news quiz with a contemporary twist on classical music. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for a Friday news quiz with October around the corner. You know what that means. Not Halloween or the dreaded October surprise or even Oktoberfest. Here at GBH and WCRB, it means a new season of the Pin Drop Sessions. It's a monthly classical-ish collaborative event series co-presented with WCRB and GBH. It runs on the first Sunday night of every month from October 2019 to May 2020 at the Aeronaut Brewery Tap Room in Somerville, Mass. Today we're fast-forwarding to the November 3rd Pin Drop Session, which features award-winning musical ensemble Blue Heron Choir, which I know you love, Marjorie.
Oh, my God, they're wonderful.
In a program called From Afar, the Sweet Light, joining us is one of the participants. That would be Somerville Mayor Joseph Curtatone. Mr. Mayor, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Jim, Marjorie, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for coming in.
And we're also joined by friend of the show, Jason McCool, head of arts and culture at Aeronaut Brewery in Somerville. He's also an adjunct professor of music at BC. Jason, it's great to see you again. How are you?
It's great to be back with you guys.
So, Jason, explain how this works. If people show up at a pin drop session, what happens?
So the first thing they do is get some beer. That's very important.
Which you brought, I should say.
Exactly. Yeah, so they get a delicious beer, and then they hopefully meet a friend, and they settle into their seats, and they experience something that is really beautiful and takes their breath away and is very unusual in terms of collaborative possibilities. And, you know, we always try to bring in some elements of theatricality, some projections, maybe perhaps some readers of medieval Italian, you know. So any kind of thing, anything goes. And every event is going to be radically unlike the one that came before it and the one that's going to come after it.
Well, so we're looking for somebody who can read medieval Italian. We may find someone.
Can't even say medieval
minutes.
Myself.
Now, Mayor Curtatone, I'm assuming since you cracked one open, you do drink beer, correct?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, how many times drinking a beer have you been watching a classical performance in your life, Mayor Curtatone?
This might be the first one.
I would assume. But is that not the whole point? I mean, it is sort of the juxtaposition of beer drinking and classical music is an odd coupling, is it not?
Absolutely. I think it's something to sort of, it's an adhesive, I guess, for creativity in this essence.
But that is the notion, yeah. Right? Is to introduce a different crowd to this kind of music.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, obviously, you know, we make our money. We have a business because we make delicious beer, and thankfully, people enjoy the product. But, you know, really what we do is provide a community space more than anything else. And, you know, people want to hear incredible music by world-class performers. And, you know, we can give that to them.
Now, let
so
me tell
Mr.
you,
Mayor,
wait,
we have to have a demonstration.
Yeah,
here.
We do. But here's how we have to do this. Do you know how we're doing this?
I don't know how we're doing
this.
We
are first going to play a little sound. Are you ready for this, Mayor Curtatone, or not? It's a big moment
for
you.
Am I singing or reading?
You can do it. You can do whatever the hell you want.
One
you got to do
some
medieval
sing.
Italian. So we're going to play a little sound from the vocal ensemble Blue Heron that Marjorie loves. They're going to be performing alongside the mayor at the second pin drop session of the season. Again, it's November 3rd. So again, first is a clip from their upcoming album, which I cannot even come close to pronouncing, which is released on October 4th, after which the mayor, is this your first public performance of medieval Italian or no?
First, definitely public reading of medieval Italian.
That is beautiful. Thank you. Let's play the music and then we'll get to the reading. Here's Blue Heron. Is Is that totally beautiful?
They're,
or is that,
they're
oh
fantastic.
My God.
They're
now,
fantastic.
This is it. You ready?
Yeah, I just want to be honest. I'm not going to sound like that.
We'll be the judge. Now, again, you're reading medieval Italian. Is that correct?
I am.
Okay, well, take it away, Mr. Mayor Joseph Curtatone. Go
I'll
ahead.
Be reading a part of an excerpt from Cipriano, from the
Excuse
composer
me?
Cipriano de Rore, I Madrigale a Cinque Voci, mm-hmm. which is a madrigal of five voices, and we can really voices of speaking of love and death. So mm-hmm. the passage I'll read with Agli amorosi strali fermo segno, sare pieno di dolce aspro martiro, ovora in libertà piango e sospiro, ai paci in cor di amante non ha loco.
That
was
really
fantastic.
Now, what does
so
that
you
mean?
Speak Italian. You speak Italian.
Thank you. It was very good.
Obviously.
I speak.
That's hard.
Yeah. So how did you come to speak Italian?
I grew up, my first language is Italian. My family immigrated to East Cambridge and eventually escaped to Somerville from a town in Italy called Gaeta between Rome and Naples. And my first language is actually a dialect called Gaetano, which has strong influence in Spanish and French, and actually Portuguese, I would say. I mean, I also learned to come to speak perfect Italian. My medieval, I'm catching up on it, but that's not too dissimilar.
So your parents were from Italy.
Yes.
So a lot of times you get here and it's like, let's get the English, let's get the English, let's get the English. But they helped you keep your language.
Yeah, actually, they did. Actually, my sister taught me English because we learned the language of my family's hometown, Gaeta, first. And,
now, what does that mean, what you just said, medieval Italian?
So, I mean, you know, translation's never direct. And
Which
you know,
means
the words
he has
are
no idea.
No, but I will read out the direct translation.
Oh, you do have it, okay.
It says, the passage I wrote means, I would be, and I'll read it in poetic form.
Please.
I would be a sure mark for amorous arrows, full of sweet, bitter suffering.
Wow.
Where now in freedom I weep and sigh.
Oh.
Peace has no place in the hearts of lovers.
Whoa.
Oh.
That is
very
crazy.
I had a feeling
you
think that's good, Jim and Marjorie. Let me have one more sip of this beer and watch how I read it.
That is what, now, before we start this quiz, you are usually here doing a quiz with the mayor of Salem. Now, I assume she is not here because she's beaten you every
I know,
year.
Thank God. I have
okay.
a shot with
okay, fine.
With a PC professor on my left.
Okay. Who do you want to ask the first question?
Okay, I'll start with the mayor, okay? You ready? You ready, Mayor Curtatone? This week, an interview with a highly successful inventor called their creation, quote, their life's biggest regret. What did they invent? A, Chester Lockhart, inventor of the child leash, said it was originally a joke that went too far. B, Wally Conron, the breeder who invented the Labradoodle, who called his hybrid breed of Labrador and Poodle Frankenstein's monster. Or C, Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the internet, after checking out this Twitter thing everybody keeps talking about. Was it the dog leash, the Labradoodle, or the internet?
Can we do more medieval Italian? I'm going to take a guess at this because I've been paying attention to Whistleblower, so I'll go with C.
I would have guessed that, too. I would have guessed that, too. But
you can steal this, Jason. Yeah. Take it away. Is it A or B?
I happen to know it's B. It's the Labradoodle
yeah.
one.
Why
yeah.
do you know that?
Yeah. I pay attention to dog news.
Oh, you
know?
Too.
I listen to your show with my dog every day, my dog Fenway.
Oh.
And see, he told me about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting thing with Labradoodle. Sometimes the mix can go very well, and sometimes it can go very bad. Have
right.
you not noticed
right,
that?
Right, right.
The poodle
right.
and the Labrador? Yeah, yeah, the face sometimes is not quite.
See, I have a Havapoo. She rocks.
Oh.
What is that?
Havanese poodle.
Is that really true?
Yeah.
Okay.
How much does it weigh?
Probably 9 pounds.
Can you say Havanese poodle in medieval Italian?
No,
you can't. Okay. Here's your question. You can go up 2-0, which would be quite exciting. A Shrewsbury resident heard about the Worcester City Half Marathon and signed up, excited about the convenience of the race, only to find out it was actually in Worcester, England. How did she respond? A dedicated runner. She decided to run a race, got herself to Worcester, Mass, and ran 13 miles alone. B, a very dedicated runner. She got herself to Worcester, England, ran the race among throngs of cheering fans. Or C, let's be honest with ourselves. We all know she sat on her couch with a pint of ice cream. Was it A, B, or C, Jason?
C is definitely what I would do, but I'm going to say A.
You are right.
That is
right.
correct. She went to what
you are right.
You knew that one, didn't you? I thought he's nodding in agreement. That's what he says.
Yeah, you never get the first one on these shows.
Okay. So it's 2-0. The mayor of Somerville is losing this particular quiz. Go ahead.
Do you want to weigh in on the whistleblower, Mr. Mayor?
Sure.
Go ahead. What do you think?
I'm just watching. I'm just watching with with attentiveness and seeing where it goes. Yeah. I mean, it's really troubling.
I mean, does this seem different to you this time or
we
not?
We were just talking about it, Jason and I, and I think like anyone else, it seems it's leading towards impeachment. That might happen in the House. That doesn't mean they have enough of conviction in the Senate. So my hope, and I think of many other people at the, you know, Senate Republicans, like that turned the tide in during Watergate, and you know, that fell short of a full impeachment proceedings. You know, they have a conscience here. And let's see where the facts take us. But right now, it's absolutely troublesome.
Question 3, Marjorie Egan to Mayor Joseph Curtatone.
Okay, here we go. On Monday, a German court made a somewhat surprising medical ruling. What was it?
Oh,
A, the court ruled that hangovers are a legitimate medical illness. B, the court ruled that Germans may be prescribed medication to help deal with the exhaustion of nonstop exposure to news coverage. Or C, the court allowed a man to be tried as his brother, who was already in prison for another crime, due to his lawyers claiming the brothers had a, quote, intense psychic link with each other.
You know, if you know this, Jason, I'm really going to be pissed. But, only because it's really entertaining, I'm going to go with C.
That
Give
was
me a
a
favor.
Great guess.
Guess A so it gets competitive. Say A.
A.
A is exactly correct. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mayor,
now, who's watching anything but Whistleblower right now?
Exactly.
That's what I really want to know.
I'm like a total loser. I'm sitting there recording stuff so I can watch it later at night. But you know something? I get all the questions wrong, too. I always fail the quiz. So we're in the same boat.
So before before we go to you, it's sort of 2-1 now in your favor. Pin drop, I assume, means so quiet during the performance that you could hear a pin drop? Is that the notion?
Right, exactly. Okay, and that's fine. What, you know, we like names where the sort of suggestions are given to the audience within the name. But yeah, you know, one of my favorite things about the series, after we've got two seasons in the bag now, there's always one moment, if there could be many moments, there's always at least one where you can almost feel the sense of the audience like leaning in to listen even harder. It's such a rare chance to get, you know, over 100 people in a room all focused on listening to something.
Where's the safe place?
Yeah.
It's in the Aeronaut Tap Room.
Where's the Aeronaut Tap Room?
It's Somerville. So, you know, sort of close to Porter Square, okay. Sort of close to Harvard Square.
Is there a website for this thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Aeronaut.net. That's Aeronaut.net. /pindrop.
So, wait a second, did you just ask where this was? Who is sitting to his right?
The mayor of Somerville.
Exactly. I don't think he's here because of the
medieval Italian.
I'll take
a note on location.
I'll tell you the truth. I wasn't sure if it was there or at WGBH, so I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. You've got to get back to Somerville. I mean, Jim's there all the time.
Maybe
you know?
I am, maybe I'm not. Okay, here's question 4. You can either go to a 3-1 lead, or maybe the mayor could tie this up. This week, a New York Times headline ran, she quit her job. He got night goggles. They searched 57 days for, the question is, for what? What did they search for? A, it's one of Marjorie and my favorite stories of the week. A, the black bear who continually destroys the couple's Trump-Pence 2020 lawn signs. B, the couple who are anti-Brexiters search for Larry, the head cat at 10 Downing Street with the goal of holding him hostage until Boris Johnson resigned. Or C, the couple search for their dog who was spooked by a thunderstorm and bolted into the woods of rural Montana. Is it A, B, or C, Jason McCool?
I'm going to go with the dog with the C.
That is absolutely
correct. It's a great story. It's a great story. She was a postal worker.
Quit her job.
Quit her job. They look for 57 days, and the ending is absolutely, it's a happy ending.
It's beautiful.
Boy, it's a great one.
Okay, so in honor of the pin drop
It's a border collie, by the way, not a labradoodle.
Oh.
Which are in Somerville, I should say, which evoke a sense of silence. We'll be quizzing our guests. That'd be Mayor Joseph Curtatone and Aeronauts Jason McCool, which is his real name, and in the answer to your question, on all things obnoxiously loud. First question to Jason, Marjorie.
Okay, here we go, Jason. The Guinness World Record for loudest band is awarded to whom? A, Kiss. B, AC/DC. Or C, Aerosmith.
Ooh, wow. That's a tough
one.
That's
a tough one. They're all pretty loud.
Gosh. Oh, the one real music-directed question, and I'm probably going to get it wrong. Let's go with AC/DC.
You did get it wrong.
God.
Now,
terrible.
While you're 2 points behind, incredibly, this question is worth 2 points.
You know what's crazy? I would have picked the same one.
So what's the answer?
A.
Yes.
You are correct.
This can't be Aerosmith. They're local.
136 decibels on July 15th, 2009, during a concert in Ottawa. For reference, a standard jet engine will clock in at around 120 decibels. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Okay, so
awful.
Mayor Curtatone, you can take the lead here. You ready for this or not? Are you ready for this or not?
Sure.
Thank you. What event happened in 1883 that produced a sound so loud it ruptured the eardrums of people 40 miles away? A, U.S. president at the time, Chester Arthur, I know one of your favorites, let out a forceful bellow when he realized he'd go down in history as America's least remembered president. B, a volcano, easy for you to say, Jim, on Krakatoa erupted with a force so great that it tore the island apart, Mr. Mayor. Or C, Buffalo Bill's first Wild West show opened in Omaha with Bill letting out a rip-roaring yee-haw. Is it A, B, or C? I'm not doing that again. A, B, or C?
I'm going to go B.
That is right. So even though it's not kosher, he sort of has a lead, Jason. Going to the final.
Wow, he's doing Jason so well. Has a lead. Now I'll feel bad for him.
What?
Read the explanation.
What is it? I didn't read that.
The explosion was so loud it's equivalent to someone in Boston hearing clearly a noise from Dublin,
that
Ireland.
That's ridiculous. Right. Well, that's
what they said,
not
Jim.
Even possible.
That's what
true.
They said.
Okay.
Whoops. Well, hold on. I totally got that wrong.
Yeah, no, you got it right.
Don't try to take my right answer back.
You got it right.
I got it right. I made so many mistakes. I thought I made another one, but I didn't.
You didn't make a mistake.
Okay, here we go, Jason.
But before we do this, to make it more exciting, let's say, even though he's behind, if you get this right, you win. If Cardatoni gets it right, he wins. So it's for all the marbles. Go ahead.
Okay, here's another sound question. Which is loudest? A, a motorcycle. B, a leaf blower. Or C, a vacuum cleaner?
A.
Now, you can win this, Mr. Mayor. This is for
you. My God, it's finally in reach. How many weeks has it been? How many months?
Well, this will be your first?
Since the last time I beat Kim, but she smoked me like 3 times.
That's true. So what's the answer?
B.
Ding, ding, ding. Congratulations.
Because maybe we were just reviewing the noise ordinance in my office recently.
Wow, I didn't know that. So leaf blowers make more noise than motorcycles.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, could you do me a favor before you leave? Could you, in medieval Italian, say, Boston Public Radio is my favorite show? Go ahead.
Not medieval. I'll say Radio Bostonia Pubblica.
Yeah.
Il mio. Say più famoso radio.
Exactly.
Radio, okay?
Thank you very much.
That's famous radio station.
That's beautiful.
You sound like a native Italian.
Well, he is practically.
Really beautiful.
By the way, the beer is great. What'd you bring?
Yeah, so this is our collaboration with the Mass Audubon Society called For the Birds.
Really?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, and it's made with millet, which is a bird seed.
Great to see you both. By the way, this thing sounds fabulous. I'm going to go.
Does.
I'm coming for you.
Some of them ask.
I'm coming.
You know where it is, Jim. You've been there. Marjorie, you're going to get back there.
I'm going to get back there. It's been a while, but I should get back there. You're right. Joseph Cardatoni is the mayor of Somerville. Jason McCool is head of arts and culture at Aeronaut Brewery in Somerville. He's also an adjunct professor of music at Boston College, and they're collaborating together November 3rd, Pin Drop Sessions, featuring the award-winning musical ensemble Blue Heron Choir. The Pin Drop Sessions are monthly classical-ish collaborative events co-presented by WCRB and WGBH that run on the first Sunday night of every month from October through May of 2020 at the Aeronaut Brewing Taproom in Somerville, Mass. Thank you, gentlemen, both for coming in.
Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you guys so much.
To another edition of Boston Public Radio, tune in Monday for All Revved Up, TV's Bob Thompson, our political roundup, which should be a whopper. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aiden Conley, our engineer, John LaClaw Parker, our on-site engineer, is David Cleckley, and special thanks to the folks at the Newsfeed Cafe.
Thank you, Newsfeed,
who give us all the food, and thank you to the people who came down to the Boston
coming,
Public
everybody.
Library as well. You're not on TV tonight, but
no,
Emily Rooney
Friday.
Is,
she
7
is,
o'clock,
yeah.
Channel
thank
2,
you.
Beat the Press, Basic Black, and of course, Jared Bowen at 8:30, Open Studio. I'm Marjorie Egan.
Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune again on Monday, and have a great afternoon.